Chapter 2. The British. How, in the first place, did a peripheral island rise from primitive squalor to world domination? Luigi Barzini. For about one-fifth of its recorded history, Britain was a conquered country, a province of the Roman Empire, and one of the more backward provinces at that. Men from other provinces ruled over Britain, but Britain did not rule other provinces. One measure of the backwardness of pre-Roman Britain was the ease with which it was conquered by greatly outnumbered Roman soldiers and held in subjugation, despite a massive and desperate uprising in 61 AD. The Romans were simply far better equipped and far better organized. In many other ways as well, the Romans represented a much more advanced civilization than existed in Britain at that point in history. Indeed, after the Romans withdrew from Britain 4 centuries later, the Britons began to retrogress, and in many respects, it was centuries after that before Britain regained the economic, social, or cultural levels it had reached as a province of the Roman Empire. The history of the British Isles shows the cultural effects of conquest and imperialism in many ways. What is now England was at first the object of conquest, and, much later in history, itself a conqueror, first within the British Isles, and then in such widely scattered regions of the world that it was possible to say, "The sun never sets on the British Empire." There was little inkling of such historic potential in the land and people that Julius Caesar encountered in a raiding expedition on the British coast in 55 BC. Indeed, not a single Briton's name had entered the pages of history before that time. The British Isles. There was no nation of England or Britain before the Roman invasions. The island was divided among 30 tribes, who fought fiercely among themselves. Their military equipment was obsolete by continental European standards, however, and their agriculture likewise lagged behind that in the Roman world. Geographically, Britain was just beyond the boundaries of the Roman Empire, which dominated continental Western Europe. Culturally, Britain was also on the fringes of Roman civilization, though using many of the cultural artifacts of that civilization acquired in trade. Britons, however, remained a predominantly Celtic-speaking people in a Celtic culture, much like that found among the conquered peoples just across the Channel. To the Romans, Britons were simply barbarians. However, these Britons were by no means merely primitive hunters and gatherers of the spontaneous produce of nature. They had agriculture, weaving, craftsmen who could work in iron, and economic transactions utilizing coins, often derivative in style from coins originating on the Channel coast of northern Europe. Nevertheless, the Britons that Julius Caesar saw were to him primitive exotics, with long hair, dyed bodies, and living in a society of shared wives. During Caesar's raiding expedition in 55 BC, his fleet met disastrous weather in unfamiliar waters off the British coast, and his cavalry was unable to get ashore. Nevertheless, the discipline and armor of the Romans prevailed, and the expedition returned in triumph to Rome with captured British slaves marching behind them in the procession. Disunity among the British tribes continued to the Roman victory. A century later, under the Emperor Claudius, the Romans returned as full-scale invaders. Claudius subdued a large part of the island and was back in Rome in 6 months. Yet the battle for the remainder of Britain continued on for decades. The British tribes took up arms with savage fierceness, in Gibbon's words, but they also laid them down or turned them against each other with wild inconstancy. The Romans, by contrast, proceeded methodically with a divide-and-conquer strategy politically and sustained and disciplined military operations. It was a difference that would distinguish the conquerors from the conquered in many parts of the world for many centuries to come. Roman Britain. Among the other common characteristics of conquerors that marked the Roman subjugation of Britain were arrogance, greed, and brutality. In southeastern Britain, for example, the king of the Iceni died in 59 AD, leaving half of his estate to the Roman emperor, in hopes that this gesture would enable his heirs to enjoy the remainder in peace and the realm to remain undisturbed, but the Roman authorities in Britain confiscated the entire estate, flogged the widowed queen, Boudica, for resisting, and raped her daughters. The oppressions and atrocities of the Romans provoked a massive revolt of the Iceni, led by Boudica, and joined by other tribes with grievances against their Roman overlords. The rebellious Britons rampaged through the southern part of the island, spreading death and destruction to Romans, Roman sympathizers, and Roman structures and symbols. Eventually, however, enough Roman military units were assembled to confront the Britons, who nevertheless had great numerical superiority. After seesaw battles in which neither side showed mercy or took prisoners, once again the superior discipline, organization, and armaments of the Romans prevailed. They then slaughtered the old as well as the young, men, women, children, and animals, throwing human and animal bodies on a common pile of corpses. The Roman authorities in Britain who provoked the Boudican revolt were replaced by men who could maintain Rome's rule without such ruinous costs. In the centuries that followed, the Romans conquered Britain culturally as well as militarily. Well-to-do Britons began to wear the Roman toga, speak Latin, and have arcades, baths, and sumptuous banquets. However, this Romanization spread unevenly down the social scale, with most Britons continuing to speak in a Celtic tongue, for example. As with other conquered peoples, it was the higher classes among the Britons who had the greatest tendency to adopt the language and culture of the conquerors, thereby acquiring some of the prestige of the dominant culture and such opportunities as existed to achieve favored positions within the new order. To the poorer masses below, working primarily in agriculture, such considerations had little weight, certainly not enough for them to take on the burden of learning a new language and a whole new way of life, though various products and practices of Roman civilization might be accepted. In short, conquest created language differences and accentuated cultural differences among the conquered people. It was a pattern that would recur in later centuries, after later conquests, both within the British Isles and in other societies around the world. Under the Romans, towns developed, roads were built, and trade flourished. The more efficient Roman plow was used for farming, pottery and metalwork were imported, and new building methods were used and taught. Window panes were introduced by the Romans, so were such mundane things as latrines. Architecture made its first real appearance, as the Britons, used to huts, now for the first time saw buildings. Sculpture and representational art in general were also introduced into a country where art before had meant Celtic designs. Roman capital helped develop the British economy. Like other less developed regions, Britain was an exporter of raw materials. The period from 96 AD to 180 has often been regarded as the golden age of the Roman Empire. It was the era of the Pax Romana, the peace secured by the overwhelming superiority of Roman military power over any possible challenger, and by an awareness in Rome that little remained to be conquered that would be worth the cost of conquest. Symptomatic of this era was a wall built to the north of Roman Britain to secure it against marauders from the unconquered northern region of the island, present-day Scotland. Roman Britain thrived during this era of peace, when Rome was invincible and its culture spread among the Britons. The enduring Roman contributions to the country included the building of a major port on the Thames. In Winston Churchill's words, "We owe London to Rome." The importance of the Roman cultural contribution to the development of Britain was demonstrated not only by the progress that took place while they were there, but also by the retrogression that took place after they left. Both covered sweeping areas of British life. The Roman legions withdrew from the British Isles early in the 5th century AD to meet growing military threats to the declining empire on the continent. By the beginning of the 6th century, British towns were crumbling, with buildings and statues in ruins, and the forests were beginning to reclaim some human settlements. Increasingly, Britain was raided and then invaded by fierce continental tribes, notably the Angles and the Saxons, two Germanic peoples from what is now southern Denmark and the northwest coastal plains of Germany, These were illiterate pre-Christian tribes who helped contribute to the destruction of much of Roman civilization in Britain, as well as eventually changing the racial composition of the British people. England. Germanic tribes settled in what is now England in a number of ways. Some were immigrant settlers during Roman times. Some were invited in during the 5th century AD as military allies to help repel attacks from other British tribes, the Picts and the Scots, ancestors respectively of today's Scots and Irish. In the centuries that followed, still more Germanic invaders arrived, pushing many of the original Britons westward toward what is now Wales, and subjugating or annihilating those who remained. These Germanic conquests were neither as swift nor as coordinated as those of the Romans had been. Various tribes, the Angles, Saxons, and Jutes, for example, independently conquered different areas, and there were periods of territorial stability before new expansions of these conquests began. Archaeological evidence suggests that most of these realms contained peoples of differing tribal backgrounds, including the original Britons. The widespread illiteracy of this age meant a lack of written records, so that less is known today about many aspects of the emerging English people, as they now began to be called, than is known about the earlier era of Roman Britain. There is much archaeological evidence that the Germanic invaders did not simply conquer and assume control over a viable Roman-British society, but rather that the existing economy and society, rural as well as urban, was largely devastated and abandoned before new barbarian communities took shape, largely independently of the locations or functions of pre-existing communities. Much of this collapse took place within half a century of the withdrawal of the Romans, which is to say, much of Roman Britain was in ruins before the dawn of the 6th century. It is questionable whether even London maintained a continuity of existence during this period. Not all the devastation of the times was due to war. Much of it represented the collapse of a culture too advanced and too complex, too economically interdependent, as well as too militarily indefensible, without the Romans who created it. As the central governmental structure of the Romans collapsed into fragmented local powers, Britons struggled to maintain some semblance of Roman culture as they retreated before the invading Germanic peoples. Many of these Romanized Britons fled to France, to what is now called Brittany. In Britain itself, Christianity, Latin scholarship, and the remnants of Roman civilization in general survived among those Britons who retreated westward and northward before the Germanic invaders. One of these Britons, St. Patrick, has been credited with transplanting this Christian civilization to Ireland. As of the end of the 6th century AD, the emerging English world was a backwater of Western civilization, an enclave of illiterate pagans in Christianized Western Europe. Markets disappeared and population declined. The economy of Britain was in general less sophisticated in the 6th century than it had been in Roman times. This economic retrogression was manifested in many ways. The market agriculture of Roman times gave way to smaller farms and subsistence farming. Imitations of Roman mass-produced goods began to be crudely handmade. The use of coins declined. Pottery ceased to be mass-produced. Roads and waterways fell into disrepair. Central heating and hot baths disappeared for many centuries. So did bricks, which the Romans used, but which did not reappear in Britain until the 14th century, when they were imported from the continent. Glass bottles, which had been produced in Roman times, disappeared from England and did not reappear until Elizabethan times, when bottles began to be imported from Venice, and it was the 17th century before glass blowing was reestablished in the British Isles. These post-Roman retrogressions pervaded both the lives and deaths of the times. The barbarian invaders practiced cremation of the dead, but, among the Christian Britons, people were now buried more crudely, in shallower graves, and increasingly, without coffins. The military vulnerability of fragmented post-Roman Britain was illustrated by the variety of raiders and invaders who struck various parts of the island. Although many of these invaders were referred to generically at the time as Saxons, they included, besides people from Saxony, Danes, who settled in the East Midlands, and Norwegians, who settled in the northwest of England, The degree to which England was altered by the invasions of Angles, Saxons, Jutes, and others, and by the later Norman invasions, may be indicated by the fact that the present-day English language contains very few words from the language of the Britons in pre-Roman times, though it contains many words of Latin, Germanic, and French origin. The Germanic conquerors, some from what is now Germany and others from Scandinavia, brought with them some of the skills that the Romans had, but not all. They could not build in stone, for example. Only after centuries of religious missionary work did the English become part of the Christian tradition of the West. The Norman invasion and conquest of England in 1066 marked the last of the great cultural and racial additions to British society from continental Europe. A people of Norse origins, the Normans had become culturally French after their conquests in France during the century and a half preceding their invasion of England. Concurrently, individual bands of Normans launched campaigns of conquest in southern Italy and Sicily, and still later, Normans would also be involved as individuals in the Spanish reconquest of the Iberian Peninsula from its Islamic rulers. In addition to being renowned warriors, the Normans were also effective as rulers, creating a reign of law and order under which economic development flourished in Normandy. They were also active in building and patronizing churches and schools, both of which were outstanding by the standards of the times. That the Normans came from France was not incidental, for France was in the forefront of European civilization, while England still lagged behind. The decisive Battle of Hastings, which settled the fate of England in 1066, was fought by about 7,000 men on each side, large numbers for their day, though very small compared to the armies of a later era of the Industrial Revolution and its accompanying advances in transportation. Thus, the Normans came to put their stamp on England and eventually on Britain as a whole. The Norman conquest meant not simply the replacement of one king with another, but a widespread takeover of land and power by Normans, a cultural revolution among the upper classes of the country, a strengthening of the power of the monarchy, an architectural revolution, and an infusion of new racial strains into an already mixed population. To the original Britons of prehistoric times had been added, over the centuries, the Celtic invaders of the 5th century BC, the Roman invaders of the 1st century AD, the Angles, Saxons, and Jutes of the 5th century, Scandinavians in the 9th century, and now the Normans in the 11th century, a mixture of peoples and cultures today very loosely characterized as Anglo-Saxon. The role of these successive conquests over the ages may be assessed to some extent by the relative development of England, which, being nearest to the continent, received their fullest impact as compared to the development of Wales, which was much less affected, or of Scotland or Ireland, which escaped conquest for centuries, largely through the accident of geography. In the wake of the Norman conquest came the French language and culture, which became dominant in the political and elite social life of England. The English people were excluded from the top secular and religious posts. Parliamentary proceedings and the law were in French, as was social discourse among the aristocracy, while Latin was the language of religious and scholarly work. The English language and culture remained largely that of the masses and the lesser gentry. The fact that the Normans held territory on the continent of Europe as well as in England, that the early kings of England were also dukes of Normandy, made the ruling class especially distinct from the English society that they ruled. King Edward III, whose reign began more than 2.5 centuries after the Norman conquest, was perhaps the first king of England who spoke more than a few words of the English language. Eventually, however, both the Norman rulers and those English who came in contact with them tended to become bilingual. The Normans were noted for their adaptability, one of the secrets of their success, but over the centuries they were said to adapt themselves out of existence. Intermarriage began early at the lower social levels and then proceeded up the scale, until eventually even kings began to marry women of English ancestry. The English language and culture correspondingly rose up the social scale over the generations and centuries. In the middle of the 13th century, an important state document was circulated in English, though this was unusual at the time. In the 14th century, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales marked the beginning of an epoch in the use of English in literature. By the early 15th century, parliamentary records and official correspondence were written in English. This was also the first century in which members of the upper classes began to correspond with one another in English. The social and cultural absorption of the Norman elite into English society was aided by the loss of the Norman connections with France, as a series of wars led ultimately to the loss of their continental territories. This loss of the continental empire was accompanied by further conquests within the British Isles. The English invaded Ireland in 1169, conquered Wales by 1284, and invaded Scotland in 1296. Individual members of the Anglo-Norman aristocracy typically had multiple landholdings over which they ruled in various parts of the British Isles, so that, despite their local attachments, they were to varying extents a national ruling class, rather than simply regional barons. It has been estimated that nearly a third of all English earls in the 13th century also held land in Scotland, while most Scottish earls held land in England. All these tendencies toward a more consolidated and inward-looking Britain, developing separately from continental Europe, were accentuated by Henry VIII's rupture with the Roman Catholic Church in the 16th century. England at this juncture was not yet on a par with the leading continental European powers, either militarily or economically. It was backward in mining and in the production of metals, and much of its international commerce was carried in foreign ships. It was still an exporter of raw materials, such as wool and agricultural products. Flanders, for example, became a major textile center in continental Europe by importing British wool for centuries, before the British themselves finally began to process their own wool into cloth. Italian shipbuilders contributed to the development of the British Navy during the reign of Henry VIII, while imported German miners contributed to the development of the British mining industry, and Dutch engineers contributed to land clearance and to the development of waterworks. As medieval England began to become transformed into a money economy, finances were at first handled primarily by Jews and Lombards, with foreigners in general conducting financial transactions that Englishmen were not yet capable of handling. After the expulsion of the Jews near the end of the 13th century, the Lombards then conducted virtually all the major financial transactions of the kingdom until they too fell into disfavor and were subjected to restrictions and predations which drove them out of the English financial markets in the 14th century. Again, however, it was foreigners from the continent of Europe who took over money lending, tax collection, and other financial transactions that produced both wealth and unpopularity. However, by the time that these latter-day financiers also fell into disfavor, there were now Englishmen able to handle financial markets, often using methods introduced by successive waves of foreigners. One relic of the era of foreign domination of English financial markets is the name of Lombard Street in modern London's financial district. In industry, as in commerce and finance, England's early economic development owed much to foreigners, and to its own stability of government and dependability of laws, which attracted foreigners. The Dutch, the Walloons, and the Flemings were among the many foreigners who brought their skills to England with them. As of 1618, there were 10,000 skilled foreign workers in London alone. Refugee groups such as Jews, Huguenots, and Flemings, all seeking respite from persecution on the continent, played key roles in England's emergence from being a backward part of Europe's economy to becoming one of its economic leaders. Between 50,000 and 100,000 Huguenots fled to Britain from France in the 17th century, particularly after revocation of the Edict of Nantes, which had previously guaranteed religious freedom to Protestants. Even earlier, however, Huguenot watchmakers had turned London from a city where no watches were manufactured to one of the leading watch-producing centers of the world. The British woolen, linen, cotton, silk, paper and glass industries were likewise revolutionized by foreign workers and foreign entrepreneurs. Moreover, as these immigrants settled and were absorbed into the English population, their skills diffused and influenced Englishmen, who now began to make their own contributions to the process. The 14th and 15th centuries marked a turning point in England's evolution from an exporter of raw materials to a producer of finished products. the country's leading export ceased to be wool and became woolen cloth. During the second half of the 14th century, England's exports of raw wool dropped by half, and its export of cloth increased more than sevenfold. In production processes in general, however, England was still importing technological advances from continental Europe until the late 17th century, when the tide began to turn in this respect as well. By the early 18th century, the net flow of technological advances was from the British Isles to the continent, and thereafter, Europe and the world continued copying and adapting British technology for most of the next two centuries. Profound and sweeping changes in technology, in the economy, and in the society were all interrelated with one another. The first great industry to emerge in Britain was the textile industry. Initially a cottage industry, cloth production in later centuries became a pioneering sector in the Industrial Revolution. The machines invented and developed in this industry, the spinning jenny, the mule, the flying shuttle, pioneered machine building in general, creating a whole class of mechanics and inventors whose skills and examples would prove valuable to heavier industry later on. The use of water wheels to tap the power of rivers and streams for turning factory machinery set the stage for applying the power of the epoch-making steam engine that would revolutionize factories, mines, railroads, and ships. While the use of water power attracted industry and workmen to places where rivers and streams could be tapped, so the later emergence of coal-fired steam engines attracted industry and workmen to places where coal deposits were found. The escalating importance of coal was reflected in the dramatic rise in the amount of coal extracted from the earth. 2 million tons at the beginning of the 18th century, 10 million tons before the end of that century, and more than 64 million tons by the middle of the 19th century. Why Britain became the first industrial nation and retained its preeminence for a century is one of the great questions of history, which is to say, one to which no definitive answer has been found. However, Britain had some unique combinations of influences. What the British had earlier than many other peoples was a framework of law and government that facilitated economic transactions. The arbitrariness of despotic government gave way in Britain to a de facto separation of powers, first between lords and king, and then between king and parliament. None of this developed in a simple progression, however. Nevertheless, the evolution of the rule of law in the British Isles not only helped promote the internal economic development of Britain itself, it helped attract to Britain, and more particularly to London, much of the commerce of Europe. Complex and time-consuming international economic transactions, including long-term investments, are particularly dependent on a reliable framework of law, so that changes of government policy or of individuals in power do not create large uncertainties as to whether commitments will be honored or foreigners treated on an equal plane with the natives involved in commercial and financial transactions. Over the centuries, British law acquired a reputation for such fairness that merchants and financiers preferred London to alternative ports and financial centers in Europe, thereby attracting vast amounts of foreign capital to supplement Britain's own capital. The fact that sovereignty in Britain was not vested solely in the person of the king meant that British kings could not repudiate national debts, and this in turn made Britain a more attractive country for lenders. While a dependable framework of law was crucial for economic development, its evolution and elaboration were accompanied by an erosion of government control over the specific terms and conditions of economic transactions, which may have been equally crucial. In Britain, as elsewhere in medieval Europe, a market meant a specifically authorized gathering place for selling on days specified by the authorities, in places specified by the authorities, and at prices specified and monitored by the authorities. Farmers would bring their produce to these officially scheduled markets or fairs, as would producers or importers of various other products, all with the presence and supervision of officials. However, the rapid growth of towns and cities and the changing locations, organization, and technology of production created innumerable economic producers, consumers, and middlemen operating outside this carefully devised framework. as large scheduled markets and fairs gave way to innumerable smaller, scattered, and continuously operating shops and stores, official control of prices and conditions became much more tenuous as a practical matter. Nor could such developments simply be forbidden without jeopardizing the growth of more and larger towns and cities and the spread of economic progress, on which the authorities themselves were dependent for the growing taxes which financed their own military and other activities. Attempts at economic controls were not abandoned in principle, and they continued to be imposed in practice wherever they could be. It was just that the effectiveness of these controls eroded with the growth and public acceptance of smuggling and other illegal or otherwise unauthorized ways of doing business beyond the reach of government officials. It was in the wake of these erosions of economic controls that intellectual challenges were then made to the role of government in the economy, first by the physiocrats in France, who coined the term laissez-faire, and then by Adam Smith in Britain, who became its leading champion. By the mid-19th century, widespread support of free trade internationally and of freeing the domestic economy from many political controls were in the ascendancy in Britain. In addition to having an economy less subject to governmental controls than in most other countries, the British people and British institutions had centuries of experience as a commercial nation before it became the first industrial nation. What Napoleon disdainfully referred to as a nation of shopkeepers was a nation with vast accumulations of experience in economic transactions, as well as a wide range of other human capital in the form of specific skills that would all contribute to its later industrial growth. Britain also underwent a transportation revolution which preceded the Industrial Revolution. Long before it was a country of factories and railroads, Britain in general, and England in particular, was a country of improved highways that greatly facilitated the movement of people, goods, and raw materials, even though they were moving by nothing more revolutionary than horse-drawn vehicles. The building of turnpikes in England began in the latter half of the 17th century, and by the mid-18th century, a substantial highway network had been created. Thanks to a continued rapid spread of turnpikes, the travel time from London to many parts of England by stagecoach in 1821 was half of what it was in 1750. By 1830, movement between the larger towns was four or five times as fast as in 1750, and all of this before the age of the railroad. The coming of the modern railroad, the first in the world being constructed in Britain in 1830, further revolutionized travel, both in terms of the numbers of passengers and in the rapidly falling cost of transporting people, goods, and raw materials. Railroads did not simply carry the same people who were previously using stagecoaches. Early in the history of the railroad, the rule of thumb developed that the rails carried twice as many people as had previously walked, taken stagecoaches, or traveled in other ways. Moreover, the cost advantages of railroads continued to improve with the technological and organization development of the rail industry, leading to ever-growing usage of the new technology. While there were 10 million stagecoach journeys in 1835, there were 30 million rail journeys by 1845, and more than 330 million by 1870. The cost reductions which made this greater expansion of trade economically possible for people who had previously been unable to afford travel also applied to freight, which included the raw materials needed by industry and their finished products to be taken to markets. The fact that these economic advantages developed first in Britain gave British commerce and industry striking advantages over those of other nations. 30 years after its beginning in 1830, the British railroad network had created the basic infrastructure that the country would use on into the 20th century. While freight traffic did not shift to railroads as early as passenger traffic, nevertheless, the change was substantial and dramatic once it got underway. In 1840, for example, virtually all the coal shipped to London came by sea, but 15 years later, about one-fourth came by rail, and 15 years after that, more than half came by rail. Ironically, while the railroad substituted for horses in many cases, the generally larger volume of transportation and the growing prosperity of people and of industry led to an absolute increase in the number of horses in Britain up till the end of the 19th century. These horses served many purposes, including some directly connected with the railroads, such as pulling carriages that took people to and from railroad stations, or from towns without railroad stations to towns that had them, or from one rail line to another when they did not intersect. A sharp downturn in the number of horses began only in the early 20th century, when the automobile and its offshoots, such as trucks and mechanical farm vehicles, appeared on the scene. In addition to the economic advantages Britain received from its technological pioneering, the country's geography was another favorable influence on its economic progress. Britain's iron ore and coal deposits were located near to one another, and both were located near the sea, an enormous advantage over most continental European countries, where even a distance of 10 miles between the two minerals was a formidable obstacle to early German industrial development, for example, in an era before railroads reduced the high cost of land transport. In Britain, however, coal could be shipped by water to Scottish ports located far from the coal fields at prices only negligibly different from the cost at nearer ports, while a shipment of coal on land was said to double in price in just 10 miles during the pre-railroad era. In those parts of the British Isles without the advantage of coal deposits or ports, industrialization was as handicapped as in other countries. Coal arriving at a Scottish port in the 18th century could sell for about £1 per ton, but the price rose 50 to 100% by the time it reached the interior highlands, where only the wealthy could afford to buy it for heating their homes. More important, the highlands could not participate in the industrialization which turned the lowlands into a predominantly urban society during the 19th century, since the highlands lacked their own coal, and it was prohibitively expensive to transport coal there from other parts of Britain. Thus, Highland Scots could participate in the modernization process only by moving down to the lowlands, to other parts of the British Isles, or overseas. In doing so, however, they would arrive at their destinations without the kinds of skills, experience, and orientation, the human capital, in demand in industrial societies. The rise of a British iron and steel industry was intertwined with the development of coal mining. The steam engine was first applied to pumping groundwater out of coal mines to enable digging to proceed deeper into the earth, thereby promoting not only the extraction of coal, but with it the production of iron and steel. Then, as the steam engine itself was improved to the point of being a practical alternative to water power for driving machines in factories, the greater stresses on the machinery created by powerful steam engines created a rising demand for iron and steel that could take such stresses better than the wooden machine parts used to transmit water power. Later, as steam engines were further developed to serve as power for railroad locomotives, coal replaced wood as fuel, and iron and steel rails replaced wooden rails. By 1870, the largest number of steam engines were being used in manufacturing, but the largest amount of horsepower supplied by steam engines was in mining, about one-fourth of the total horsepower produced by steam in the country, with textiles next, using nearly one-fifth of the nation's horsepower supplied by steam. The declining demand for wood as fuel and as an industrial material, due to the rise of coal and iron, respectively, freed land from timber growing for agricultural production, or allowed it to revert to woodlands. Woodlands in Britain increased in area by more than one-fourth between 1873 and 1911. It was not merely things that developed. People developed. Textile mills began to locate in the vicinity of ironworks, because there one could find skilled mechanics familiar with machinery and able to repair and maintain textile machinery, as well as the other machines they dealt with. Engineers and mechanics were as much products of the industrialization process as the material goods and the machinery by which those goods were produced. So were inventors. More patents were issued in the quarter century after 1760 than in the preceding 150 years. British mechanics and engineers were in demand around the world. Many made repeated trips to the new United States of America, where their skills and knowledge were in great demand during the late 18th and early 19th centuries, while others went to various countries in continental Europe or even to Japan. As late as 1876, there were more than 100 foreign industrial workers in the Japanese railroad industry alone, and of these, 94 were British. In Russia, more than 100 Scottish industrial workers arrived in St. Petersburg on a single vessel. The movement of skilled artisans was especially important during the early phases of British industrialization, when the predominant form of human capital consisted of individual experience, personal knacks, and trial and error methods, rather than the application of science, which would come later. Not only did Britons travel abroad to spread industrial knowledge, other countries sent mechanics and engineers to Britain to learn the most advanced information in their fields. These included Americans, Germans, Japanese, and Norwegians, among others. Over time, however, machines made individually by the knack of particular craftsmen began to be replaced during the 1820s to the 1840s by machines made in a standardized manner by machine tools. Using machines to make other machines allowed finer tolerances to be maintained, sometimes down to a thousandth of an inch, and this in turn meant that parts could be made interchangeable. Standardized and systematized production of machines also promoted the rise of engineering as a profession for which people could be trained. The export of British technology and the emigration of the people who understood that technology was on such a scale as to cause laws to be passed forbidding both, so as to maintain British preeminence, but such laws proved to be very ineffective. However, it was 1825 before these laws were repealed. None of these developments occurred with the kind of suddenness or pervasiveness suggested by the phrase industrial revolution, but the profound depth and eventually far-reaching scope of these incremental changes certainly deserved that title. Life would never be the same again, either for Britain or for the world. For example, Englishmen introduced railroads to the rest of the world, not only by the example of railroad building in their own country, but also by themselves building and manning the first railroads in Germany, Argentina, India, Russia, Uganda, Kenya, and Malaya, as well as financing the building of railroads in the United States, France, and elsewhere. Railroads, in turn, were revolutionary in their social consequences. The concentrations of the world's populations along coasts and near rivers was reduced as land transport into interior hinterlands became cheaper. This was even more of a factor in countries with large, landlocked interiors, such as Germany, the United States, and Russia, than in England itself. It has been said that the characteristic feature of 19th century economic development was the development of continents instead of coastlines. Germany in particular was freed from its dependence on North Sea ports, which could freeze over in the winter, and became instead a hub of railroad networks that stretched across Europe. As a nation located in the center of the continent, Germany could, for example, ship its own and other countries' goods in all directions, establishing rail links that ultimately reached the Mediterranean and through it the Middle East. Inside Germany, railroads made it economically feasible to bring the iron ore of Lorraine to the coal fields of Westphalia, enabling Germans to become major producers of steel, and with it, one of the leading industrial powers of the world. One indication of the historic role of the British in bringing railroads to Germany is that, of the 240 locomotives in Germany in 1840, 166 came from England. In the United States as well, the coming of the railroad age permitted separate deposits of iron ore and of coal to be brought together for the production of iron and steel, the ore from the vicinity of Lake Superior, for example, being transported by rail to the coal deposits near Pittsburgh, which became one of the great iron and steel producing centers of the world. The British role in the world's shipping was no less dramatic. In addition to inventing the steam engine that facilitated massive international emigration and made possible the international shipment of bulky and relatively low-valued commodities such as wheat, the British built many of the world's transoceanic ships, in addition to carrying much of the world's international commerce in British ships, for other countries as well as for themselves. As late as 1912, Britain carried more than half the goods shipped across the seas of the world. In addition, British shipyards built more than half the tonnage of steamships used by France, Russia, Spain, Holland, Italy, and Belgium. The revolution in transportation created by the railroad and the steamship affected not only industry and commerce, but also the lives of millions of ordinary people. As late as the mid-19th century, only the affluent could afford such things as tea, coffee, sugar, raisins, oranges, and cocoa, but cheap transportation made all these things available to the masses. Perishable commodities, like fish, could now be sold internationally, when swift and cheap transportation on the high seas was combined with refrigeration en route. Thus, English fish was sold in Switzerland, and even Canadian salmon was sold on the European continent. Not only things, but people moved more readily, some for permanent settlement abroad, but many to work just for a season in agriculture or in the building trades before returning home. Thousands of Russians went to Germany when it was time to harvest crops there, just as Italian agricultural workers went to Argentina for their harvest, and Italian buildings trades workers traveled seasonally to the United States. Transatlantic travel became quicker, cheaper, and safer. The horrendous death rates from crossing the Atlantic in the era of wind-driven ships were drastically reduced, partly because steel steamships do not sink as often as wooden sailing ships, and partly because the much shorter times spent on the water subjected people to fewer danger of debilitation and illness. Steamships also largely rid the seas of the centuries-old worldwide scourge of piracy, for steamships were too expensive for freebooters to finance, and sailing ships could no longer suffice to enable pirates to catch steamers. Moreover, steamships required ports where they could refuel with coal, and pirates could hardly expect to obtain this service from their potential victims. At the heart of the industrialization process was iron and steel, and Britain was preeminent in their production. As of 1830, the production of pig iron in Great Britain was nearly double that in Germany and France combined. As of 1871, the British produced more steel than Germany, France, Sweden, and Austria combined. British agriculture was also acknowledged to be the best in the world. Britain likewise spearheaded the development of the modern textile industry, supplying not only the major inventions, but also initially the managers and skilled labor needed to train foreign workmen to operate British-made machinery in Russia, China, India, Mexico, and Brazil. British firms also dominated the production of mining and other heavy equipment in late 19th and early 20th century Chile. In short, British technology and British capital were transplanted and took root around the world, in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, as well as in such offshoots of British civilization as the United States, Canada, and Australia. Partly as a result of a massive shipment of capital goods, British exports in the early 1870s exceeded the exports of the United States and Germany combined. The effect of early 19th century industrialization on the standard of living of ordinary working people in Britain is a question long shrouded in controversy. However, what is clear is that industrial regions of Britain attracted large numbers of people from the countryside and from smaller towns, that the wage rates paid in industrial centers were higher than in rural areas, and that consumption patterns indicate that these higher wages were not simply dissipated in meeting higher costs of living in the cities, but represented a real increase in what people could afford to buy. High death rates in large industrial centers were a sobering reminder of the negative aspect of industrialization, as accidents, overcrowding, with accompanying vulnerability to endemic and epidemic diseases, and perhaps the congregation of people from different disease environments with different levels of resistance to one another's disease, all added to the hazards. Nevertheless, these hazards were known at the time to the people who moved to the cities, so their choices to move there suggested what their trade-offs were. Moreover, the overall death rate in Britain changed very little from 1820 to 1870, because increasing lifespans in the rural areas offset the higher death rates in urban areas. The rising wealth of the country, deriving from industrialization, may well have contributed to the increasing life expectancy outside the urban industrial centers themselves. The longer-run effects of industrialization on living standards in Britain were even more clearly positive. Even Karl Marx, who spent more than three decades living in Victorian England, acknowledged the rise in British workers' living standards between the 1840s and the 1860s. Although the question as to why England became the standard-bearer in the advancement of human, economic, and technological achievements in the world may never be fully answered, its location, institutions, and social practices were all conducive to this result, though clearly not determinative, as shown by the long centuries during which Britain lagged behind continental Europe and other parts of the world. However, during the era when European civilization emerged as the most economically and technologically advanced in the world, Britain had the advantage of being able to share in that civilization, while being an island nation spared the country the direct ravages of the wars that repeatedly disrupted and devastated the continent. Even when the British took part in these wars, they fought on other people's territory or at sea. Internally, both the political system and social practices were also favorable to economic development. Stability of government and laws, and security of property, made it possible to raise vast aggregations of capital from the public at low interest rates for projects that took decades to complete, such as canals and railroads. The long-term interest rate in Britain was 6% at the beginning of the 18th century and fell to 3.5% by mid-century. Social factors were also favorable in England, where the prosperous and educated classes were a functional factor in commerce and industry, as well as in agriculture, letters, law, and politics. In Scotland as well, land ownership might be crucial for entry into the upper classes, but did not preclude careers in law or commerce. For all the snobbishness of British society, its aristocracy was not sealed off from the mundane, practical, economic concerns of the nation, as were those of many other societies, where an hereditary aristocracy hindered or stifled the spirit of enterprise, thereby holding back national economic development. Moreover, the rise of the gentry and the decline of the nobility in Tudor times, and the intermingling of these gentry with people of the commercial class, meant that gentlemen in Britain could also be businessmen, and vice versa, making not only the wealth but the talents of the more fortunate classes available for the economic development of the country. The younger son of the Tudor gentleman was not permitted to hang idle about the manor house, a drain on the family income, like the impoverished nobles of the continent who were too proud to work. He was away, making money in trade or in law. Among those of the landed gentry who remained on the land, the enterprising spirit of improvement was also apparent. New crops, new agricultural methods, and new techniques in animal husbandry were widely introduced by landowners in England. As new methods of raising feed for animals made it easier to keep them alive over the winter, the widespread and almost automatic slaughter of animals in the autumn ceased, leading to a year-round supply of fresh meat that changed the English diet, greatly reducing diseases growing out of the heavy salting of meat that had formerly been necessary when far more meat was slaughtered than was needed at one time and had to be stored. By the 18th century, England was one of the leading nations of Europe in agricultural technique and in the commercial development of farming, as distinguished from the feudal serfdom of Eastern Europe or the small peasant farming of much of continental Western Europe. At the lower end of the social scale, as well as among the gentry, enterprise and social mobility were part of the pattern in England. Most hired farmhands, for example, did not live out their entire lives in that role, but usually moved on to other occupations after marriage. Moreover, people in a wide variety of roles on the land, great landlords, small owners, tenants, and hired hands, all produced for the marketplace. The number of people in the agricultural population grew absolutely with the growth of population in general, though their proportions declined as the country industrialized. Around the middle of the 19th century, the total number of people working in British agriculture reached its peak at 2 million, constituting just under one-fifth of the total population of the nation. As the number of farmers began to decline, total agricultural output continued to rise for some time due to increased productivity, but the share of agriculture in Britain's total output declined to just 6% by the first decade of the 20th century. By this time, however, Britain was importing more than half of its beef, mutton, and lamb, and three-quarters of its wheat. Other nations had some of the advantages of England, but none combined them all. Germany had large iron ore and coal deposits, but not as close together as in England, and the numerous tariff barriers between the disunited German states and principalities before the formation of their customs union in the early 19th century were economically crippling. France was lacking in iron ore, and, like Germany, had no such advanced financial institutions as England's to finance industrialization. Even a French entrepreneur who developed the first successful machine for spinning linen yarn in the late 18th century went to England to get financing for his venture because he could not raise the needed capital in France. Scottish inventors, including James Watt, likewise sought financing in England to produce their inventions commercially. France had the intellectual foundations for modern industry without the commercial and financial complements. French chemists, such as Lavoisier, Berthollet, and Leblanc, made fundamental contributions to the development of modern chemistry, but here too, what they contributed was then commercially applied first in England. With its takeoff into the industrial age, England emerged from centuries in the shadow of continental European powers and left a lasting imprint on the world, greater than that of any other nation since the days of the Roman Empire. Indeed, the worldwide scope of the British impact was far beyond anything possible in Roman times. However, having set in motion the Industrial Revolution and spread its technology worldwide, Britain in the last decades of the 19th century was faced with the international competition of rapidly growing industrial rivals. As of 1870, Britain produced 32% of all the manufactured goods in the world, followed by the United States at 23% and Germany at 13%. By 1913, however, Britain's relative share of the world's growing supply of manufactured goods was down to 14%, exceeded by Germany at 16% and by the United States at 36%. This loss of world leadership in industrial output was perhaps inevitable, given that Germany, the United States, and other industrializing nations had much larger populations than Britain. However, Britain was overtaken not only in gross output, but also in output per worker. It lost its lead in technological innovation. After producing more than 40% of all the major inventions, discoveries, and innovations in the world from 1750 through 1825, Britain found its relative share declining, and ultimately being surpassed by the shares of Germany and the United States. By 1950, Britain's share was down to 3%, and that of the United States was 82%. In short, British inventiveness and efficiency did not keep pace. One factor in the loss of British economic preeminence in the world was Britain's earlier development of strong and widespread labor unions, which were able to restrict the application of new technology, both directly and by appropriating a sufficient share of technology's economic benefits to reduce the incentives for further technological investment. In the United States, by contrast, industrial labor unions did not become dominant in the major industries until the late 1930s. An ironic consequence of this difference in industrial unionization was that much British labor and British capital moved to the United States, where both were more productive than they were at home. Other factors in Britain's relinquishing its economic and technological lead include a failure to standardize its products to the extent that German, American, or Canadian firms did, and a neglect of technical education. Despite Britain's dependence on exports, it often failed to adapt its products to foreign tastes, or their marketing to foreign languages, or even to quote export prices in foreign currencies, rather than in the complex system of British shillings, pence, and pounds sterling that existed before British money was put on the decimal system in the late 20th century. Wales. Wales, as a rugged mountainous region, was for many centuries a refuge for peoples fleeing those with greater power, who could not be confronted on the plains of England or on the continent of Europe. Wales could be fled to by land or by sea, or via rivers from England. Innumerable peoples settled in what is now Wales and eventually intermingled. Cultures, like peoples, survived in Wales after vanishing from other parts of Britain. The rugged geography of Wales made it not only a refuge, but also a land internally divided by natural barriers, which in turn became cultural barriers among its peoples. Like many such geographically divided areas in various parts of the world, Wales was fragmented politically as well as culturally. Over the centuries, major outside political forces, the Romans, the Normans, and then the English, were able to penetrate Wales, especially along the coastal lowlands and in the central river valleys, while other parts of Wales remained less affected by the invaders' influence. The region that is today Wales resisted Roman conquest longer than the southeastern portion of Britain that is now England. The Roman expedition dispatched to conquer Wales in 61 AD had to be recalled to put down the revolt of Boudicca. Nevertheless, toward the end of the first century of the Christian era, Wales was conquered and became part of the Roman Empire. However, archaeological evidence suggests that Wales was not as culturally Romanized as England, but remained instead a militarily secured frontier area. Just as the Romans took possession of what is now Wales some years after taking possession of what is now England, so they abandoned Wales some years before abandoning Roman England. In short, Wales felt the impact of Roman civilization to a lesser degree and for less time than did England. Welsh speech remained Celtic rather than Latin, for example. The progress of the Welsh during the centuries of Roman rule has been characterized as negligible. The southeastern part of Wales was unique in having a significant number of Roman villas, but the region as a whole was never fully incorporated culturally into Roman civilization. When later centuries brought invasions of southeastern Britain by Angles, Saxons, and others, some of the Britons there amalgamated with the conquerors, some fled west to be absorbed by, or to absorb, the population already living in the Welsh region, while others crossed the Channel to settle on the northern coast of France. Many others may have perished in the wars and epidemics of that era. The numbers and proportions of these historic rearrangements of races remain obscured in the mists of time. Usually history is written by the conquerors, but the Anglo-Saxon conquerors of Britain were illiterate. One scholar has called this era the shadowy phase of British history, and another has more bluntly said, informed guesswork must make do for history, for much of this period that was decisive for the social transformation of Britain. Even the great figure of King Arthur is not known for certain to have existed historically. What is known is that remnants of the culture of Roman Britain survived in Wales, both in material things and in Christianity. The next great wave of conquests, those of the Normans, are much more fully documented. The Normans, like the Romans 1,000 years earlier, conquered England more quickly and decisively than they conquered Wales. The struggles and revolts of the Welsh over the centuries gave them enduring traditions as a people separate from the English, who ultimately established political and economic dominance. Ironically, it was a British king of Welsh ancestry, Henry VIII, who attempted to abolish Wales as a separate cultural and political entity. However, the Act of Union with England in 1536 by no means led to the cultural or biological absorption of the Welsh, despite efforts to fasten English culture and institutions on Wales. That act made English the official language of Wales and declared that those who spoke Welsh could hold no official office. This had much more impact on the Welsh gentry, who subsequently became Anglicized, than on the mass of the Welsh people, who had no realistic prospects of such advancement in any case. By 1640, the Welsh gentry was well on its way to being Anglicized, and many of its children attended Jesus College at Oxford, a college established in the previous century, largely for Welsh students. Just as the English language became the official language of Wales in 1536, so the Anglican Church became its officially established church, supported at the expense of the Welsh, most of whom did not belong to it. It was centuries later, after long political struggles, before the Anglican Church was finally disestablished in Wales in 1920. Religious grievances were among many sources of Welsh separatism and resentment of the English. Medieval Wales, though not as economically advanced as most of contemporary Europe, had nevertheless a more complex agriculture than that of a simple subsistence economy. There were estates, tenants, slaves, and property rights. Wales also had England as a market for its agricultural and meat products. A relatively backward agriculture in Wales became a more progressive agriculture after exposure to more advanced English practices. Still, the agricultural revolutions that transformed England and Scotland came later and more slowly in Wales. Welsh landlords lacked the capital for carrying out some of the more ambitious reorganizations of agriculture that took place elsewhere, and a lack of good roads limited the marketability of Welsh produce. Sharp class differences and class hostilities have long marked the history of Wales. Welsh landlords, for example, being predominantly Anglicized in culture, English-speaking, political Tories, and of the Anglican religion, while their tenants were predominantly Welsh in culture, Welsh-speaking, political Whigs, and belonged to various religions outside the established Anglican Church. Before the secret ballot was introduced in 1872, landlords sometimes retaliated with rent increases or evictions against tenants who did not vote as the landlord demanded. Similar differences of culture, language, religion, and politics existed between the urban industrial employers, whether English or Welsh, and their workers. The poverty and vulnerability of the Welsh masses further embittered class relations. Like the Scots in earlier times, the rural Welshmen of the 18th century wore homemade clothing and typically lived in crude dwellings containing little that could be called furniture. Their thatched roof cottages also served as homes for pigs and poultry as well. An absence of soap and a meager diet usually meant poor health. Such diseases as smallpox, typhus, scarlet fever, and even cholera ravaged the Welsh as late as the first half of the 19th century. The passing generations brought economic improvements, but poverty and a periodically precarious existence remained grim facts of life for many in Wales. Wales was among the first regions of Europe to industrialize, due largely to its huge deposits of coal and the availability of English capital, technology, and entrepreneurship to develop coal-related industries. The copper smelting industry, for example, began in Wales in 1584 and became a world center of this activity. At various times, Wales has also had the largest iron-making town in the world, was dominant in world production of tinplate, and became a major supplier of coal in the era of international steamships. However, outside the realm of primary metals processing, Wales had little manufacturing. Still, as early as the mid-19th century, more than 60% of the Welsh labor force worked in non-agrarian occupations. The urbanization of Wales was so rapid that its population went from 80% rural in the early 19th century to 80% urban by the early 20th century. Welsh miners were central figures in the country's economic and social history. As of 1914, the coal mines in Wales employed more than 250,000 people and supplied approximately one-third of the world's coal exports. The thrust of modern industrialization in Wales came not primarily from the Welsh themselves, but from foreigners, and continued to do so even in the late 20th century. Great iron mills in Wales were created by English capitalists, as were many other businesses there, some of which also attracted workers from England and Ireland, though mostly from rural Wales. Prosperous foreigners employing Welshmen in hard, dangerous, and dirty occupations in mining and metals industries promoted a resentful nationalism already rich in historical fuel. Limited upward movement may also have contributed to Welsh labor militancy. In the middle of the 19th century, a government investigator said, "The Welsh workman never finds his way into the office. He never becomes a clerk or agent. He may become an overseer or contractor, but this does not take him out of the laboring and into the administering class." Language long remained a cultural barrier between the Welsh and the English, and a symbol of Welsh identity, much longer than in Scotland or Ireland. Industrialization did not change that. The Welsh language remained dominant in most industrial areas of Wales until at least the beginning of the 20th century. However, the official British policy of teaching only English in the schools, beginning in 1870, with punishment for children caught speaking Welsh, eventually eroded the indigenous language among succeeding generations. Only half the population of Wales still spoke Welsh in 1901, fewer than 40% in 1921, and fewer than 20% in 1981. This decline was especially pronounced among the young. Wales' most famous writer, Dylan Thomas, spoke no Welsh. More than sheer coercion was involved, however, for this would not explain the great variation in the survival of Welsh in different geographical regions. The English language became dominant in southern and eastern Wales, where the majority of the Welsh population lived, and where the industrial and commercial incursions from England came earliest and most transformed the life of the Welsh people, while the Welsh language remained dominant in the northern and western hinterlands. In those parts of Wales where the English created a modern commercial and industrial economy, the English language was a means of upward mobility, a chance to escape the coal mines and the drudgery of the mills and factories. This incentive meant much less in those parts of Wales where farming and livestock were the principal means of livelihood. While in centuries past, the masses of the people in Wales clung to their native tongue as the more fortunate classes chose English, in the 20th century, a small resurgence of the Welsh language, led by the Welsh intelligentsia, became a nationalistic political symbol. Their key successes were produced in the British political arena, rather than by persuading the Welsh people to readopt their ancient language. The Welsh Nationalist Party, Plaid Cymru, won an occasional parliamentary seat or two in the heart of the Welsh-speaking region, and various demonstrations, vandalism of signs in English, and other factors have provided leverage with which to gain concessions from London. The Welsh Language Act of 1967 accepted the principle of equal validity of the English and Welsh languages in Wales. Some schools were established teaching in the Welsh language, reversing the decline of the language among the young, the bulk of whom still spoke only English, however. A Welsh-speaking television channel was also established by the British government, pleasing not only the Welsh-speaking population, but also the English-speaking population of Wales, which before resented having their viewing interrupted by programs in Welsh. The political activities of Welsh nationalism have not been simply a matter of the Welsh people versus the English people. Within Wales itself, nationalism in general and the language issue in particular have been divisive. A referendum on greater home rule in Wales was overwhelmingly rejected in 1979 by the Welsh themselves out of the mutual fears of different factions. Ambivalence toward identity and acculturation has long marked the history of the Welsh. The development of new steel-making processes in Britain was especially a boon to Wales, where much iron and steel were produced. By 1911, more than 22,000 men were employed in steel production in southwest Wales. As of 1913, coal, steel, and tinplate production in Wales were at an all-time high. Moreover, the First World War created a still greater demand for such products. However, the wartime boom was followed by a drastic reduction in world demand for these products from Wales, not only because the wartime uses were no longer sustained, but also because alternative sources of supply developed elsewhere in the world. By the 1920s, the demand for coal, steel, and tinplate from Wales were at a new low. Unemployment rates among Welsh workers remained consistently above 20% from the mid-1920s to the late 1930s, sometimes rising as high as 37%. Not all Welsh industry declined in tandem. The copper industry began its decline in the 1860s, for example, and some had rebounds. But the role of Wales as a major industrial center of the world was gone by the second half of the 20th century. By the late 20th century, Wales was economically and socially transformed by the decline of its historic industries, coal, iron, steel, non-ferrous metals, and textiles. Coal mines, which once employed more than 250,000 people, now employed less than one-tenth that number. Employment in the steel industry of Wales was, by 1988, less than one-third what it was at its peak in 1970. Altogether, unemployment in Wales was even higher than in England, as both rates more than doubled in less than a decade. There was still no entrepreneurial tradition among the Welsh, their educated classes typically seeking teaching or political careers, and their universities having a strong anti-business outlook. Many of the ablest young people in Wales went away to England, often to study at Oxford or Cambridge. Major Welsh-owned businesses, with the notable exception of Laura Ashley, tended to be located outside Wales. In the late 20th century, Wales had the lowest per capita output of any region of mainland Britain, and was still handicapped by poor roads and poor rail transportation, as well as by the natural geographic barriers of this rugged land. Moreover, the Welsh have been regarded by businessmen as poor credit risks. Much of Wales' economic activity, agricultural as well as industrial, now survived on heavy subsidies by the British government. While Wales developed a sizable tourist industry, especially along the southern coast, it has been in general regarded as an unattractive place to live. Ancient and declining industrial cities, slag heaps, and the vandalism of nationalistic extremists made it still less attractive. Nevertheless, there were some new industries being created in the late 20th century. In fact, nearly one-fourth of all direct foreign investment in Britain in 1983 to 1984 went to Wales. The largest concentration of Japanese-owned industry in Britain was in Wales, and a South Korean electronics company made an investment in Wales that was the largest overseas investment in Europe. A large pool of available labor seems to have been Wales' major attraction, especially now that hard times had muted the Welsh Labour Union's historic militant radicalism and brought more pragmatic cooperation with management. With the new industries, as with the old, however, Welsh labor was used more to produce parts rather than finished products, to do low-skill work even in high-tech industries. The history of Wales as a conquered country shows patterns common elsewhere, not only in the British Isles, but also in Africa, Asia, and the Western Hemisphere. Where the conqueror has been more organizationally or technologically advanced, those portions of the conquered country which were subjugated earliest and most thoroughly have tended to become, and remain, the most advanced regions, even in countries which later regained their independence. Another pattern has been that internal divisions created or accentuated by different levels of exposure to the culture of the conquerors have complicated and impeded political or cultural unification among the conquered. While labor unions developed somewhat later in Wales than in England, Welsh unions became noted for their militancy, and the Welsh voters for their support of the Labour Party. The only competition for the Welsh vote, after the decline of the Liberal Party led by the Welsh Prime Minister of Britain, David Lloyd George, was the Communist Party. Monumental strikes and lockouts marked labour relations in Wales, where the interaction of ethnic and class differences made for particularly embittered industrial strife. One of the most militant left-wing British Labour Party figures in the mid-20th century was Welsh Member of Parliament Aneurin Bevan. The history of Wales illustrates the great difficulty of creating an entrepreneurial tradition where none has existed before, even after centuries of exposure to the entrepreneurial activities of outsiders. The creation or expansion of an indigenous educated class in these circumstances tends not to supply entrepreneurship, but on the contrary, to create a class with a vested interest in promoting intergroup resentment and strife, using the symbols of identity and of historic oppression to gain current political ends, even at the expense of creating a climate unfavorable to either indigenous or foreign entrepreneurship. Bitter economic consequences may sometimes mute these tendencies, however, as they did in late 20th century Wales. Scotland. The northernmost portion of Britain, what is now Scotland, was never subdued by the Romans, nor was a conquest of Ireland attempted by the Romans, though it was contemplated as a relatively easy task. That Scotland was not conquered was due to the poverty of the land as well as to the fierceness of its tribes. The Romans decided that it was simply not worth the trouble. Eventually, around 122 AD, the Emperor Hadrian had a wall constructed across a narrow isthmus south of Scotland to protect Rome's British province from marauders. Scotland thus remained largely cut off for centuries from developments in England. A comparison of the two countries provides at least some rough indication of the impact of Roman civilization and of Anglo-Saxon and Norman influences, all of which filtered only belatedly into Scotland from England. Scotland long remained what all of Britain had been before the Roman invasion, a country on the fringes of European civilization, not only geographically, but culturally, economically, and politically as well. Scottish agriculture, as late as the beginning of the 17th century, still used farming implements as primitive as those of ancient Mesopotamia. Houses lacked furniture. People went barefoot or sometimes wore crude shoes made of hides that might be tanned or not. It was common for animals and humans to share unventilated, shanty-like homes, leading to an abundance of vermin. The demand for soap was so small that no one manufactured it. Politically, Scotland for centuries lacked a national framework of law and order. Each local baron was virtually a law unto himself, and murderous feuds among the clans kept the country in an uproar internally, while wars and skirmishes with England made the border regions insecure. These border regions were plagued not only by the recurrent wars between the English and the Scots, but were more continuously rendered lawless by murderous marauders who flouted the authorities of both countries and paid little heed to kings or clans. Scots regularly raided settlements in northern England, carrying off livestock and people as slaves, among other booty. Neither towns nor industry could flourish in these circumstances. Even some of the leading towns in Scotland in the 13th century numbered their inhabitants in the hundreds rather than the thousands. The total population of the country apparently remained below 1 million as late as the 16th century. Even in the 17th century, the largest city in Scotland, Edinburgh, had only 16,000 people. Roads were much worse in Scotland than in England, and most could not accommodate a horse-drawn carriage. In medieval Scotland, trade was usually by barter, and such coins as circulated were usually foreign. The Scots were unable to manufacture even the arms they used in their incessant battles. Spears, armor, and bows and arrows were imported. Skilled labor was virtually unknown. Scotland was primarily a supplier of raw material, salt, fish, coal, wool, skins, and hides, for example. Ignorance and superstition were widespread. There was said to be no 14th century Scottish baron who could write his own name. A succession of medieval Scottish kings tried to establish law and order and to move the country forward economically and culturally in the direction of England, which represented a more advanced European civilization. These Scottish kings, where possible, replaced the tribal basis of power in kinship with the feudal basis of power in territory. This often involved making grants of land to new Anglo-Norman noble families and establishing royal burghs, whose urban residents were typically English speakers rather than the indigenous Gaelic-speaking Celts. These burghers, possessing craft skills and commercial experience still lacking among the Celts, were able to prosper, and these many enclaves have been regarded as one possible reason for the spread of the English language, which eventually replaced Gaelic as the language of the Scottish lowlands during the Middle Ages. In the countryside as well, Scots landlords brought in English farmers and plowmen to teach their tenants the agricultural methods used in England. None of this was accomplished quickly, fully, or uniformly, and all of it encountered resistance, often bloody and sometimes successful, by the indigenous clans and nobles. Royal power was unevenly effective at different times and places. It was least effective in the rugged highlands, which maintained their freedom from the conqueror and their isolation from European civilization. The Scottish Highlands were able to hold out for centuries, maintaining a Gaelic-speaking society with older indigenous traditions, as the lowlands blended the indigenous culture with anglicized practices and adopted a Scottish dialect of the English language. Newcomers to Scotland from England, Scandinavia, and the continent began to blend in with the lowland Scots, leading to a new cultural gulf between lowland and highland Scots that persisted for centuries. The highland Scots derived much of their livelihood from plundering the farms and towns of the lowland Scots. It was said of these highland raiders that their greatest pleasure was stealing, and their next greatest pleasure was destruction. A 14th century writer described the lowland Scots as people of domestic and civilized habits, and the highland Scots as a savage and untamed nation, rude and independent, given to rapine and exceedingly cruel. Scandinavians and Normans, as well as lowlanders and highlanders, contended for various parts of medieval Scotland, and Scottish kings battled their own nobles as well as the English. In addition, many local kings of both British and Scandinavian ancestry had realms in various parts of the British Isles, including Scotland, until a consolidation over the centuries reduced the realms to those of the Scottish and the English kings. Only the advent of gunpowder and cannons swung the balance of power decisively in the royal direction, enabling European kings in general, who maintained a monopoly of this new and expensive weaponry, to batter down the castle walls of recalcitrant nobles and establish a unified order. England launched an invasion of Scotland in the late 13th century. In the 14th century, the English captured the Scottish town of Berwick, subjecting it to what Winston Churchill called a sack and slaughter which shocked even those barbaric times, for the inhabitants were not simply killed, but tortured to death, and the king himself set fire to their homes. For centuries thereafter, Scottish soldiers fighting the English used the cry, "Remember Berwick," and they skinned alive captured English officers, setting off new rounds of atrocities and counter-atrocities. During those centuries of strife, the contested borderlands were not simply a region of battles between opposing armies during intermittent warfare. They were a continuously lawless frontier where feuding clans, marauders, vigilantes, and protection racket extortionists flourished. In short, these were not loyal followers of either English or Scottish kings, but freebooters who were said to be Scottish when they will and English at their pleasure. Among the enduring consequences of these centuries of borderland disorder was the development of a culture of disregarding the law and settling disputes by personal violence, whether violence between individuals or between families. Rustling, squatting on land without legal title, abductions of women, and ruthless brutality in general became some of the hallmarks of lawlessness among these frontier people, whether on the frontiers of Britain or, later, on the frontiers of America. Border people were also prominent among the Scots who settled in Ulster County, Ireland, contributing to the enduring turbulence there as well. Along with the internal pacification of Scotland over a period of centuries came an easing of military hostilities between Scotland and England over an even longer span of time. The uniting of Scotland with England was to be the work of centuries of war and political intrigue. When Scottish King James VI inherited the English throne and became King James I of England, the two countries were partially united politically in 1603 with one king, but still maintained separate parliaments and separate political institutions in general. Just over a century later, they were fully united, with one parliament in London in 1707. This marked not only a political, but also an economic, social, and cultural turning point in the history of Scotland. As with the earlier Roman conquest of Britain, the first economic and social fruits of unification were law and order. With the pacification of the borders, trade grew between England and Scotland after four centuries. England was, at this point, far ahead of Scotland economically, as well as in population and power, so that resumption of trade represented an exposing of Scots to a more advanced society, as well as to the immediate benefits of trade. Scottish cities grew rapidly in the 18th century. There were improvements in industry and agriculture. Trade was now open not only with England itself, but also with the British Empire as a whole. The export of Scottish linen doubled in the decade between 1728 and 1738. The population of Scotland grew rapidly as the death rate declined sharply. By the middle of the 18th century, Scotland had about 1.25 million people, and over the next three quarters of a century, that population nearly doubled. The economic and cultural evolution of Scotland was complicated by religious, dynastic, and military struggles, growing ultimately out of the historic Protestant-Catholic split that convulsed much of Europe. The last desperate uprising in the Scottish Highlands in 1745, designed to restore the Catholic Stuarts to the throne in the person of Bonnie Prince Charlie, marked a cultural turning point in the history of the Highlands. Despite some initial successes, including the capture of Perth and Edinburgh, the forces of the Pretender were ultimately routed by a combination of English and Loyalist Scottish troops from the Lowlands. Bitter reprisals and a punitive peace followed, breaking the power of the Highland clans and their chiefs, both militarily and politically. For a time, even the wearing of kilts and clan tartans was forbidden. With much of the foundation of Highland culture destroyed in the wake of the abortive 1745 uprising, the Highlands began to be absorbed culturally, as well as politically, into the life of Scotland and of Great Britain. The Gaelic language, which still dominated the Highlands in the mid-18th century, began to give way to English. Rhodes brought into the Highlands the religion, the schools, the law and order, the agricultural practices, and the general way of life of the lowlands. The Gaelic language and culture were stigmatized as barbaric, even among the Highlanders themselves, and Highland chiefs began to send their sons to be educated among the lowlanders. Over time, the Scottish population in general tended to concentrate more and more in the lowlands. Among the lowland Scots, Anglicization had begun much earlier, particularly among the wealthier and more educated classes. This acculturation extended well beyond the use of the English language to domestic lifestyles, agricultural practices, and sometimes religious observances, most of the Scottish elite belonging to the Church of England rather than to the Scottish denominations. A sense of the cultural inferiority of Scotland was found even among leading Scots. In their zeal to imitate English agricultural methods themselves, and to promote these methods among Scots in general, the anglicized Scottish elite seldom inquired into the suitability of English farming practices to the different climate and soil of Scotland. A widely introduced English plow, for example, ended up being widely abandoned after it was found to be less effective in the rocky Scottish soil. On the whole, however, the reorganization of Scottish agriculture along the lines of English agriculture improved output, even though this reorganization often displaced tenants and subtenants. As of the middle of the 18th century, most Highlanders spoke little English, and even in the early 19th century, Gaelic had still not died out in the Highlands. But when the Scottish Highlanders changed from speaking Gaelic to speaking English during the 19th century, they put themselves in touch with more people and a more advanced culture among their contemporaries, as well as now having available to them a vast literature in English, reaching back through centuries of intellectual development in many fields, and a literature reaching back 2,000 years through English translations of ancient writers. By contrast, Gaelic was largely a spoken language, with very little literature, and those who spoke it could seldom read it. In short, what was involved was not simply a change of language, but acquiring a whole new intellectual universe, which expanded enormously beyond the essentially non-literate Gaelic folk culture. This did not mean that the average Highlander was reading the ancient classics, but the Scottish intellectual classes could not avoid being affected by the ideas of other times and places, as well as the ideas of English-speaking contemporaries around the world, if only through an awareness of how much more there was to the human experience than the Highlands, and this awareness could not help filtering down to erode the insularity of centuries past. The cultural progress of Scotland, especially in the Lowlands, was by no means all imported from England. Even before the Union of Crowns with England in 1603, Scotland had made remarkable progress on its own. The change from Catholicism to Protestantism, promoted by John Knox in the 16th century, led to a Presbyterian church of wide popularity, which used its great influence and resources to create schools and promote education on a massive scale. Initially, this was education in a narrow orthodoxy, and none of the leading scientific, literary, or artistic figures of Europe made an impact on Scotland. But in a country where even the nobility had been ignorant, now even the commoners became educated. By the late 18th century, the lowlands of Scotland had developed the most extensive system of education in Europe. Moreover, education was now a vehicle of upward mobility, especially within the church. With the passage of time and the rapid spread of education to all levels of Scottish society, there developed for the first time an intellectual class in Scotland. It was not only the quantity, but also the quality of this intellectual class, which contrasted sharply with the previous condition of Scotland. As historian Henry Buckle put it, "In every branch of knowledge, this once poor and ignorant people produced original and successful thinkers." These included not only the great philosopher David Hume, but also men who pioneered in shaping whole new fields of intellectual endeavor, such as economics, Adam Smith, chemistry, Joseph Black, and sociology, John Miller. In literature, there was the poetry of Robert Burns and the novels of Sir Walter Scott. Scotts were among the leading architects of the age, notably Robert Adam, whose work had international repercussions on the design of everything from palaces to bookbindings. In applied science, James Watt's steam engine made possible not only manufacturing industries and railroads, but also revolutionized travel on rivers and oceans, with global consequences for the migrations of peoples and the transport of goods. In medicine, as in other fields, Scotland was a late starter, but quickly moved to the forefront. The Edinburgh University Medical Faculty was established in 1726, using as its model the Leiden Medical School in the Netherlands, where all of its original professors had studied. By the second half of the 18th century, however, Edinburgh itself was considered the leading medical school in Europe. It both attracted an international student body and sent its Scottish doctors overseas. Between 1720 and 1790, about 12,800 men passed through the Edinburgh Medical School. Dozens of these doctors settled in Virginia alone, and many others were scattered throughout the American colonies. Graduates of the Edinburgh Medical School established the first American medical school in Philadelphia in 1765, and 3 years later, another graduate of Edinburgh founded the medical school at King's College, later renamed Columbia University. The medical school established at Dartmouth in 1798 was likewise founded by graduates of Edinburgh. Scottish physicians also became common in 18th century Russia and included the court physician to Catherine the Great. Another Scot became head of the medical chancery at St. Petersburg. From the mid-18th to the mid-19th century, a disproportionate share of the leading British intellectual figures were either from Scotland or of Scottish ancestry, including, in addition to those already mentioned, Francis Hutcheson and Thomas Reed in philosophy, James Mill and John Stuart Mill in economics and political science, and Thomas Carlyle in history. Scotland also produced Britain's leading intellectual journal, the Edinburgh Review. The dominance of the Scots in British intellectual life was akin to that of the Jews in other countries, with the important difference that the Scots had no such centuries of intellectual tradition to draw upon. Moreover, the Scots were not merely preeminent in Britain. In their golden age, during the last half of the 18th century, Scottish intellectuals as a group were among the leading intellectuals in European civilization. The social origins of these outstanding intellects were by no means random. Virtually all were from the Scottish lowlands, and neither the poor nor the aristocracy were well represented. Most of the leading Scottish intellectuals came from middle-class backgrounds. The Scottish aristocracy played a role as patrons of this talent, and in some cases as its discoverers and financial supporters, the classic example being James Mill, who was sponsored by Sir John Stuart, and in gratitude named his firstborn after him. That the rich, though well-educated during this period, should be so little represented at the intellectual peaks may seem to be an anomaly, but perhaps the complacency of assured social position dulled the incentives necessary for the arduous task of developing native talents to the fullest. The achievements of the Scottish Enlightenment were all the more remarkable for originating in a small country, smaller than either Portugal or Guatemala, or the American state of Florida, with a population less than half of present-day New York City or Tokyo. Moreover, these leading intellects were not drawn from this whole population, small as it was, since the rich, the poor, and the Highlanders, except for philosopher Adam Ferguson, were not included. Another peculiarity of the golden age of Scottish intellectuals was its concentration in time and in fields. There had been few Scottish intellectuals of international renown before, exceptions being Duns Scotus in the Middle Ages and the 17th century mathematician John Napier, who created logarithms and introduced the decimal point, but nothing like the golden age of the 18th century occurred before or since. Moreover, even within this era, the Scots made little or no impact as playwrights or in the field of music. That the Scots did not reach these peaks before has been explained, first, by their lack of education, and then by the oppressive control of education by the Scottish Church in an earlier period. But that this intellectual predominance did not continue remains largely unexplained. At a more mundane level, the Highlands as well as the Lowlands were drawn into the economic and cultural progress of Scotland after the union with England in 1707, though with a lag that kept the Highlanders long in arrears. Standards of social behavior tended to be cruder in the Highlands. Education spread more rapidly in the Lowlands than in the Highlands, and the potato was introduced into the Lowlands about 15 years before it was introduced into the Highlands. Both Lowlanders and Highlanders long considered themselves behind the people of England in manners, polish, and sophistication. The Highlanders tended to copy the Lowlanders, and the Lowlanders to copy the English. Educated Scots sought to purge their speech of Scotticisms. This was not simply a matter of subjective perceptions. Many Scottish practices, particularly as regards sanitation, lagged behind what was acceptable in England. The legendary lack of cleanliness of the rural Scots became even more dangerous as they migrated to the city. A visitor to Edinburgh in the late 18th century found it worthy of note that its inhabitants no longer threw sewage out their windows into the street. Passers-by had long had to be on the alert to avoid having this sewage fall on them. Improvements in this respect were paralleled by numerous other improvements in manners, dress, household furnishings, and cultural activities, much of it financed by a growing prosperity in Scotland, beginning in the middle of the 18th century. The wages of Scottish day laborers rose faster than the cost of living between 1760 and 1790. In the wake of rising income came rising standards of living over time, though this happened gradually and unevenly across the social spectrum. While glass window panes began to appear in the windows of some of the larger farmhouses and churches in the early 18th century, many Scots at mid-century still lived in hovels that could be constructed in a day, measuring about 12 feet square, with roofs of straw and turf laid over rough branches. As late as 1861, more than one-fourth of the population of Scotland still lived in one-room houses, but fewer than one-tenth did so half a century later. The rising prosperity of the Scots was associated with a shift of the working population from agriculture into industry. As late as the middle of the 19th century, one-fourth of all employed Scots worked in agriculture, but that was down to 11% half a century later, and to 4% in 1971. In the Highlands, however, more than 40% of its working population worked in agriculture as late as 1911. For Scotland as a whole, the shift from agriculture to industry was paralleled by a shift to larger and larger communities. As of 1861, 28% of the Scottish population lived in communities of 50,000 or more people, and none in communities of half a million. But, half a century later, 42% were living in communities of 50,000 or more, including 20% in communities of half a million or more. Per capita income in Scotland was not nearly as high as that of the United Kingdom as a whole by 1911, though the dependence of this prosperity on heavy industry made Scotland particularly vulnerable to changing world markets and the rise of competing industrial regions around the world. Thus, unemployment in Scotland was higher than in England from the late 1920s through the late 1930s. In some respects, Scotland did not merely catch up with England, but overtook it. This was especially striking in education. As early as the 18th century, some of the English aristocracy were sending their sons to Scotland for an education in universities that were considered outstanding at a time when Oxford and Cambridge were considered stagnant. Among American colonists who studied at British universities, more went to Edinburgh than to either Oxford or Cambridge. In addition to the primacy of Scottish medical and engineering education, at the more mundane levels, the Scots also came to compare favorably with the English. Thus, primary school education became compulsory in Scotland in 1872, 17 years before it became compulsory in England, and became free in 1889, 2 years before it became free in England. While the number of university students in Scotland was never as large as the number in England, due to the disparities in populations of the two countries, in proportion to its population, Scotland had far more university students than England as early as 1830, and as late as 1950. While illiteracy in Scotland in 1750 was 22% for men and 77% for women, A century later, this was down to 11% among bridegrooms and 23% among brides, though the regional variations ranged from 1% for both sexes in lowland Berwickshire to 37% of men and 49% of women in some highland communities. By 1917, illiteracy was down to 1% for both sexes in Scotland as a whole, and less than 3% even in those highland communities where it had been so high in the mid-19th century. Unlike Ireland or Wales, Scotland developed its own class of entrepreneurs, industrialists, and financiers. As with England, Scotland had a commercial class long before it had an industrial class. Many Scots rose from modest beginnings to become business magnates of national or even international stature. Engineering, steelmaking, shipbuilding, textiles, and chemicals were just some of the industries in which the Scots excelled. Most of these industries developed from small beginnings in the early 19th century. As of 1805, Scotland produced just 5% of the pig iron made in the United Kingdom. By 1835, it produced nearly 30%. In 1831, the shipyards on the Clyde River employed 3% of the British shipbuilding labor force, but by 1871, they employed 21% and launched 48% of the ships built in Great Britain. Many technological innovations of the Industrial Age originated with Scots. For example, a boiler developed by a Glasgow engineer powered about 3/4 of the British merchant marine fleet by 1876. The world's first university chair in engineering was founded in Glasgow in 1840. Scottish universities forged ahead of English universities in science, pure and applied, while traditional classical education prevailed among the English. Japan, newly emerging on the world scene in the late 19th century, sought its science and engineering in Scotland. In agriculture as well, Scotland began the 18th century behind the English, but, after copying and applying English methods of farming, then surpassed the English in agricultural technique. Scottish agriculture underwent a far-reaching transformation from long traditional methods to modern farming practices that greatly increased output per acre, raised the real wages of farm workers, and increased the average size of landowners' holdings. Between the mid-18th century and the early 19th century, this economic revolution was accompanied by large, and not always welcome, changes in social patterns, reducing the class of tenant farmers and increasing the number of landless agricultural laborers, as well as replacing stable traditional roles and expectations with the fluidity and uncertainty inherent in a changing market economy. One consequence was greater geographical movement within Scotland, as those displaced from ancestral lands and occupations wandered in search of work elsewhere. 1/3 of all Scots in the mid-19th century moved from one county to another, and for some, there was emigration to other lands around the world. The enduring importance of these historic developments may be indicated by comparing two groups of Scots, one of whom experienced their full influence and one of whom did not. In 1610, the British opened Ulster County in Ireland to settlement by Englishmen and Scotsmen. The opportunity was especially attractive to people from then poverty-stricken Scotland, who predominated numerically among those who migrated to Ireland, though the English settlers were financially better off. The Scots who began to settle in Ulster left their homeland when it was still a very backward country on the fringes of European civilization. These Scots lived as frontier settlers and colonizers in a hostile land where the dispossessed and embittered Irish continued armed resistance for years, in a sporadic sense, for centuries. The historic ferocity and clannishness of the Scots enabled them to survive in this hostile environment. 3 decades after the project began, there were 40,000 Scots in Ulster. Others continued to join them over the years, now coming from a more advanced Scotland, so that not all Ulster Scots, or Scotch-Irish, as they later came to be called, were either poor or uneducated by any means. Nevertheless, their lag behind other Scots could be seen both in the British Isles and later, overseas, in the United States and Australia. Ireland. A common characteristic of Celtic peoples, both on the continent of Europe and in the British Isles, was their inability to unite into forces of national dimensions, even though they covered vast areas that today constitute several nations. Julius Caesar's victories in Gaul were in significant part a result of the disunity of the Celts there and of his ability to divide and conquer, both politically and militarily. The Celtic tribes that dominated pre-Roman Britain were conquered for the same reasons a century later. 1,000 years after that, a similar internal disunity made Ireland vulnerable to conquest by a united Britain. While the fragmented Irish resistance was unable to drive out the British invaders, neither could the British score a decisive victory for centuries. There was no central government whose surrender or collapse would be recognized by the Irish as marking the end of the war. Although the invasion of Ireland began in the 13th century, as late as the 15th century, effective British control did not extend beyond some walled towns and a coastal strip of land around Dublin. Even after later centuries brought complete British military conquest of Ireland, underground resistance groups rose and fell, sporadically spreading terrorism or launching mass uprisings that were bloodily suppressed. The most spectacular and embittering of the British suppressions of the Irish was Oliver Cromwell's punitive expedition of 1649, ostensibly to avenge Protestants killed in a Catholic uprising in 1641. Cromwell, who hated Catholics in general and priests in particular, was merciless in battle and vengeful after victory, killing defenseless prisoners and confiscating vast areas of land from Irish owners to award to British settlers. As of 1641, the indigenous Irish Catholics owned an estimated 3/5 of the land of Ireland, but just 24 years later, this proportion was down to 1/5. By 1709, the Irish owned only 14% of the land in their own country. Cromwell's punitive expedition marked a watershed in Irish history. An estimated 40% of the Irish population died either in the war or in the famine which accompanied the devastation. In the aftermath of Cromwell's subjugation, the Irish became a people without many basic rights in their own land. Under the penal laws imposed on Ireland, they could neither vote nor hold office nor receive military commissions. They could not freely practice the Catholic religion nor receive any education but Protestant education, and they were taxed to support the Anglican Church. While these and other penal laws were not consistently carried out to the letter in all cases, the Irish suffered other disabilities imposed without the sanction of law. Many British landlords, for example, maintained their own private jails to punish the Irish, and while this was illegal, grand juries repeatedly refused to indict landlords found practicing this particular form of oppression in Ireland. Underground Catholic education and underground terrorist groups were among the Irish responses. Brutal guerrilla warfare was directed not only at the British overlords, but also against Irish collaborators. The British were equally implacable in suppressing such movements and hanging their leaders. Eventually, however, a non-violent political movement emerged as the penal laws were relaxed, leading to agitation for their complete repeal. This finally happened in 1829. In what has been called Catholic emancipation. The dire poverty of the early 19th century Irish may be indicated by their average life expectancy of 19 years, compared to 36 years for contemporary American slaves, and the fact that slaves in the United States typically lived in houses a little larger than the unventilated huts of the Irish and slept on mattresses, while the Irish slept in piles of straw. Slaves also ate a wider variety of foods, including low grades of meat, while an Irishman, subsisting on potatoes and occasionally fish, might not see meat from one year to the next. Bad as these normal conditions were among the Irish masses in the early 19th century, worse conditions followed in the 1840s, when potato blight destroyed the crop that provided their basic nutrition. In the Great Famine that ensued, about 1 million people died of starvation and diseases related to malnutrition. Close to 2 million emigrated between the mid-1840s and the mid-1850s. The poorest tended to settle in nearby Britain, while others went to the United States, usually in the cheapest, most crowded, and most stark and dirty accommodations on passenger or cargo ships. Upon arrival, whether in England or the United States, the Irish typically lived in the worst slums amid the greatest filth and worked in the least skilled, lowest paid, and most dangerous occupations. Such massive outflows of population from Ireland went to Britain and the United States that, by 1891, nearly two-fifths of all living people born in Ireland were living outside Ireland. Ireland's population of 8 million people in 1841 fell to only half of that by 1926. Even in the late 20th century, there were more people of Irish ancestry in the United States than in Ireland. The Irish were one-third of the population of Great Britain at the beginning of the 19th century, and less than 10% of the British population by the middle of the 20th century. Culturally, the Irish were drawn into the orbit of the English in language, but not in religion or politically. By the mid-19th century, the indigenous language was still being spoken by only about a fifth of the people in Ireland. Yet, nine-tenths of the people in Irish counties were Roman Catholic. Industrially, the Irish lagged far behind the English. Unlike Scotland, Ireland did not become more industrialized after its act of union with England. On the contrary, Irish industry, with the exception of linens, declined after the union with England in 1801 because it could not compete with English industry. Nor was Irish agriculture as advanced as that in England, which had resident landlords overseeing farming techniques, while Irish landlords were more often absentees living in England on the rents of their property in Ireland. Scotland was also well ahead of Ireland in economic development. While the Scots established themselves as bankers, both at home and overseas, not one private bank was opened in Dublin in the quarter century before 1793. In the early 20th century, Scottish industrial workers produced about 20% more output per capita than Ireland's industrial workers, and Scotland's industries as a whole produced nearly four times the output of Ireland's industries, even though the two countries had very similar-sized populations at that point. Politically, the struggle for independence from Britain reached a climax in 1922, when the Irish Free State was formed, making most of the island independent, except for predominantly Protestant Ulster County. Although the majority and minority in Ulster are conventionally described with religious labels as Protestants and Catholics, they are in fact different ethnic groups, and their continuing bitter differences are not religious as such. Independent Ireland escaped the social strife and terrorism which continued to plague Ulster, but independence did not solve Ireland's historic economic and social problems. High unemployment, one of the heaviest tax burdens in Europe, and a national debt exceeding the annual gross national product were some of the grim indicators of Ireland's economic condition at the end of the 1980s. With an annual emigration of 46,000 people, Ireland's population of 3.5 million was still declining, despite one of the highest birth rates in Europe. Although the Irish Free State's standard of living was significantly lower than that in Ulster, the latter's standard of living was in turn below that in the United Kingdom as a whole, despite being subsidized by the British taxpayers, since Ulster received more from the British government than it paid in taxes. Within Ulster, the Catholic population has tended to be poorer than the Protestant and less represented in higher-level occupations, as well as more represented in public housing projects. All this points toward differences in human capital, such as have marked the Irish, compared to the Scots or the English, in other countries around the world. The preferred explanation among the Irish in Ulster, however, has been discrimination, even though the evidence for such discrimination consists largely of statistical disparities rather than actual individual examples. Among students, the Irish Catholics tended to study science and technology less often than Ulster Protestants did. Britain in the world. British history is by no means confined to Britain, for no other nation has had such a large and enduring role in shaping events, institutions, and the fates of other peoples around the world. Much of the world today, including the United States, is still living in the social, cultural, and political aftermath of Britain's cultural achievements, its Industrial Revolution, its government of checks and balances, and its conquests around the world. Many fundamental concepts of law and government, and the traditions that make them viable, originated in Britain, as did much of the technology that made the modern world possible. While the technological influence of the British in leading the world into the industrial age has reached every corner of the globe, and the legal and political example of the British system of government has influenced countries on all continents, the more direct transplantation of Britons has been concentrated in a relatively few places, mostly offshoot societies such as the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Here, there has been transferred not a single British culture, so much as a collection of British cultures, varying not only among such ethnic groups as the English, Welsh, Scots, and Irish, but also among groups bearing the same ethnic label, but coming from different parts of the British Isles with contrasting cultural backgrounds. The social impact of these groups in other countries not only reflected their initial differences in Britain, but also helped shape the history of the countries in which they settled. Britons overseas. The British people may be divided along many lines other than purely ethnic lines. Nor are these other divisions any less sharply contrasting, just as the Irish, the Scots, the Welsh, and the English have had different histories at home and overseas. So have different people from contrasting regions of England, contrasting regions of Scotland, or the peoples of what has been loosely called the Celtic fringe as a whole, as compared to those from the more anglicized parts of the British Isles. Like other culturally distinctive groups, the Irish have taken their way of life with them around the world. Whether at home or abroad, the distinctive behavior patterns of the Irish have been striking, though not all these patterns remained unchanged over the generations. The Irish immigrant generations of the 19th century, whether in Britain or the United States, were largely an unskilled urban proletariat, settling in large cities but living a way of life more suited to the rural world from which they came. For example, 19th century Irish city dwellers kept pigs and fowl and disposed of their garbage in the streets, whether in America or England. Not surprisingly, in both countries, cholera and other filth-related diseases struck Irish neighborhoods particularly hard. Fighting and widespread alcoholism were also hallmarks of the Irish abroad, as in Ireland itself. The occupational distribution of the Irish living in 19th century Philadelphia was very similar to that of the Irish living in London at the same time. Much the same story could be told of the Irish in Australia, though here a significant number settled in rural areas. The great majority of Irish men in Australia were laborers, and the great majority of Irish women were servants. As late as the 1880s and 1890s, more than 95% of Irish women working in Australia were domestic servants, as were a similar proportion of Irish women working in the United States at that time. In Argentina, however, the availability of land grants drew many of the Irish immigrants away from their initial settlement in Buenos Aires. The Irish who left the city often formed communities where Irish names continued to predominate even in the 20th century. Surviving initially very difficult conditions as shepherds on a sharecropping basis with the sheep owners in the early 19th century, the Irish prospered as international demand for Argentine wool and sheep increased. The Catholic Church was a central feature of Irish life, at home and abroad. The Church played a major role in the social development of Irish immigrants and their assimilation to higher standards of education and behavior, so that the Irish of later generations became much more socially accepted in the larger societies in which they lived in Britain, Australia, and the United States. In Argentina, however, Irish Catholic organizations kept the immigrants a separate community, fearing that they might otherwise degenerate to the level of the surrounding Argentines, even though the latter were also Catholic. Arriving Irish immigrants were met at the dock, the men steered toward jobs with Irish employers, and the women toward marriage with established Irish immigrants who had arrived before them, and the children of these marriages were educated in English-speaking Irish Catholic parochial schools. The newspapers the immigrants read in Argentina were English-language papers, dealing with news from the particular counties from which they had come in Ireland. These cultural enclaves began to be broken up only after the rise to power of Juan Perón near the middle of the 20th century, leading to the end of specifically Irish schools. Around the world, the Irish have been especially successful in fields requiring insights into human relations. politics, writing, law, labor union leadership, rather than fields requiring mathematical, scientific, or entrepreneurial aptitudes. The organizational skills of the Irish, developed while maintaining their own underground religious and secular institutions in Ireland, proved to be a major factor in their advancement to leadership positions in labor unions and in politics in urban communities, whether in Britain, the United States, Australia, or Canada. Of 110 labor union presidents in the American Federation of Labor in 1900, more than 50 were Irish. Irish control of American big city political machines in the 19th century was scattered literally from coast to coast. Whether in the U.S., Britain, or Australia, Irish politicians tended to be concentrated on the left, but the pragmatic left, concerned with obtaining immediate, tangible benefits for their working-class constituencies, rather than an eventual reconstitution of society along ideologically defined lines. In Britain, the Irish have been concentrated in the Labour Party, in the U.S., in the Democratic Party, and in Australia, in the Australian Labour Party. There were four second-generation Irish Prime Ministers of Australia who dominated politics in that country during the era from 1929 to 1949. Britain and Canada have also had Irish Prime Ministers. The United States elected its first Irish President in 1960 and its second in 1980. The Welsh have likewise had their own distinctive patterns at home and abroad. One of their differences from the Irish, for example, has been in the far lesser tendency of the Welsh to emigrate at all. In proportion to their respective populations, the Irish have immigrated to the United States more than 20 times as much as the Welsh. Those Welsh who did go overseas took their cultural patterns with them, including not only such things as being minors in both Australia and the United States, but also their language, their religion, and their ambivalence about their ethnic identity. An isolated Welsh colony was established in 19th century Argentina in hopes of preserving their cultural identity. Yet the people in this colony ended up having to call on the British government for help, and conversely, when World War I came, Welshmen from Argentina volunteered to go fight for Britain. Eventually, however, the descendants of the Welsh in Argentina began to speak Spanish and were culturally absorbed as Argentines. The Welsh in the United States have likewise been absorbed into the general American population over time, though the early Welsh immigrants remained separate in language and largely endogamous in marriage in those places where there were sufficient concentrations to make this possible. Early Welsh settlements in Pennsylvania left a legacy of place names from Wales, including Bryn Mawr, Haverford, Radnor, and Marion. Since Wales was the first nation in the world with more than half of its population working in non-agricultural pursuits, it is hardly surprising that Welsh immigrants to the United States went heavily into mining and into steel mills, though many also became farmers, often in hills and valleys resembling those in Wales. When a mine fire in Pennsylvania in 1869 killed more than 100 miners, at least two-thirds of them were Welsh. Among the famous Americans of Welsh ancestry were Thomas Jefferson, Jefferson Davis, Charles Evans Hughes, and the legendary labor leader John L. Lewis, the L standing for the historic Welsh name Llewellyn, whose union was in the traditional Welsh occupation of mining. In Australia as well, mining was a principal occupation of the Welsh. The discovery of copper in the colony of South Australia in the 1840s led to the first significant Welsh immigration, which tripled the local Welsh population from 300 to 900 by 1851. Many of these early immigrants spoke Welsh rather than English, and some gave Welsh names to the streets in the neighborhoods where they lived. More discoveries of copper in South Australia, and later gold in the colony of Victoria, increased the Welsh population in Australia several-fold. Although there were fewer than 400 Welsh living in Victoria in 1851, there were more than 6,000 a decade later. By 1865, there were at least 21 Welsh chapels, as distinguished from Anglican churches, in Victoria. One of the major coal mining regions of Australia not only became a magnet for Welsh miners, but was also named New South Wales, a colony and later a state with various local Welsh place names as well. In the colony of Queensland to the north, Welsh coal mining communities sprang up, and with them, Welsh religious institutions using the Welsh language. Outside these concentrations in mining communities, however, the Welsh were culturally absorbed into the predominantly English population of Australia. However, as late as 1886, half the Welsh population still spoke Welsh, though this declined rapidly among the younger generation born in Australia, and a much reduced immigration from Wales meant that there was little reinforcement of the Welsh culture from overseas. Attempts of Welsh activists to promote colonies that would keep their culture alive failed in the 19th century, and ethnic revivals under the multicultural banner in the late 20th century were too little and too late to stop the cultural and biological absorption of the Welsh into the general Australian population. The traditional breakdown of the peoples of the British Isles into English, Scots, Irish, and Welsh does not capture all the cultural divisions among them, nor necessarily the sharpest cultural divisions. Britons of the same nominal ethnicity have often differed greatly according to their regional backgrounds within England or within Scotland, for example. Thus, there were large cultural differences between the Highland Scots and the Lowland Scots overseas, as there was at home, or between each of these and the Scots who settled in Ulster County, Ireland. Most of the Scots who immigrated to colonial America did so as indentured servants, whose passage was paid by Americans, for whom they would later work free for years in repayment. Highland Scots who immigrated to North America settled primarily in North Carolina, but predominated in different regions of that state from those in which the Ulster Scots were concentrated. Language differences long kept the Highland Scots separate from other Scots and from the American population in general, for Highland Scots still spoke Gaelic in 19th century America, and in parts of the region in which they settled, Gaelic had still not died out completely, even in the late 20th century. The Highland Scots who immigrated to Australia in the early 19th century likewise spoke Gaelic and required translators, as well as being largely illiterate and unskilled. While the subsidized emigration schemes which took them to Australia were criticized in the Highlands for having taken the cream of the local working population, in Australia the criticism was that these Highlanders were the dregs of the Scottish emigration. Given the differences between the Highlanders and the Lowlanders at that juncture, there was no necessary inconsistency between these two claims. Most of the Lowland Scots came from urban, industrial, and commercial areas of Scotland and went to similar areas in Australia. Even those Lowlanders who worked in agriculture came from a background of agriculture in Scotland that was advanced for its time. But many of the Scottish shepherds in Australia were Highlanders, reflecting in their new homeland one of the patterns of the old. Though Australia and New Zealand attracted more than half of all Scots emigrating from the British Isles in the middle of the 19th century, the proportion of Highlanders among them declined over time, suggesting that the adverse comments about them might have had some basis, and, thereafter, more than 90% of the Scots arriving in Australia were Lowlanders. Among Scots in general, however, there was a remarkable record of achievements overseas. Unlike the Highland Scots or the Ulster Scots, most Scots immigrating from Scotland to the United States, for example, did not form enclaves, but tended to assimilate into the general population. They were noted for their industriousness, and many brought industrial skills still scarce in America. Even in the late 20th century, Americans of Scottish ancestry had incomes significantly above the national average. Scots in general achieved prominence and prosperity in America from the beginning. 9 men of Scottish ancestry were generals under George Washington, constituting more than one-third of all his brigadiers. Nearly one-fifth of the members of the Congress that adopted the Declaration of Independence were of Scottish extraction, as were two-thirds of the governors of the original 13 states. Over time, more than 100 men of Scottish ancestry became governors of American states, and 30% of all U.S. Supreme Court justices from 1789 to 1882 were of Scottish ancestry. In Australia as well, most Scots blended into the general population rather than maintaining separate enclaves, though the Highlanders among them sometimes tended to remain socially and culturally distinct longer. The first Scots arriving in Australia, like the first people of many other backgrounds, were convicts. However, the Scots were numerically underrepresented among these convicts, though they were said to be among the worst criminals, since Scottish courts were more reluctant to sentence any but the worst criminals to transportation to Australia. However, even in this early colonial period, there were also distinguished Scots in the colony, including Lachlan Macquarie and Sir Thomas Brisbane, both of whom became governors of New South Wales. The Scots' long traditions as fighting men were reflected in their military careers overseas. In the British military forces in India in the 18th century, 1/3 of the officers came from Scotland, though in Britain itself, Englishmen alone outnumbered Scots about 5-to-1 in the population at that time. The long military tradition of the Scots kept them in demand as soldiers on the continent of Europe as well. In France and in Poland, there were royal bodyguards of Scots, and thousands of Scots fought in the Swedish army during the Thirty Years' War. Scots also played an important role in modernizing Russia's military and naval forces. A Scot attained the rank of general in late 17th century Russia, and in the 18th century, another Scot became a vice admiral. As early as the 16th century, a Scottish military man was made governor of Kiev, and in the 18th century, another Scot became governor of Kronstadt, while yet another became governor of the Ukraine. There were also Scottish generals in Prussia and in the Habsburg Empire. In the Western Hemisphere, there was a Scottish vice-admiral in the Chilean Navy in the 19th century, and Venezuela's battle for independence was aided by a Scottish officer who led Aboriginal Indian troops into battle to the sound of bagpipes while dressed in his traditional Highland regalia. As in Scotland itself, commerce and industry were fields in which Scots excelled overseas, both as workers and as entrepreneurs. These enterprises were not simply Scottish firms with overseas branches or operations. Often they were firms with no connection to Scotland, except for the Scottish ancestry of the people who founded them and ran them, though many also sent back to Scotland for employees. Scottish merchant firms operated in China, India, Australia, Africa, the United States, and Canada. An 18th-century Scotsman named Simon MacTavish became known in Canada as the uncrowned king of the fur trade. Half of the board of directors of the first bank established in Canada were Scotsmen, and Scots were also prominent among bankers in Australia and India, while in Japan, a Scotsman established a school of banking, whose Japanese students went on to become their country's bankers in later years. There were enough Scots in Meiji-era Japan to organize lodges in Yokohama, Kobe, and Nagasaki. Meanwhile, many ships for the Japanese Navy were built in Scotland. Shipbuilding was also a skill that the Scots took with them to other countries. As early as 1798, Scottish firms were constructing ships in Canada, and a year later, one of them was building the largest ship ever built in the maritime provinces up to that time. By the early 19th century, a Scottish firm in Canada had the largest fleet of ships in the British Empire, employing 5,000 men on these ships and in the shipyards, as well as 15,000 men in the Canadian forests from which their timber came. The first plate iron floating dry dock in Latin America was built by a Scotsman, its inventor, in 1863. In other fields as well, Scots had notable careers abroad. There were Scottish scholars teaching in French and German universities. A Scot pioneered in metallurgy and machine building in Tsarist Russia. As businessmen, Scots ranged from peddlers to large-scale merchants and bankers, and operated from the villages of Poland to the fur-trading outposts of Canada. There were so many Scots in Holland that there was a Scottish church in Rotterdam. In the 17th century, an estimated 30,000 Scots lived in Poland. Most worked as peddlers. Like most middleman minorities who have taken on the role of peddlers and shopkeepers, the Scots faced local resentment and discriminatory laws designed to restrict their economic activities, not only in Poland but in Prussia as well. In Poland, political attacks on Scots linked them with the classic middleman minority, the Jews. Nevertheless, some Scottish merchants in Poland became members of Polish guilds, and other Scots became town councillors, aldermen, and even burgomeisters. The first sugar refinery in Danzig, present-day Gdansk, was built by a Scot. Some members of the Scottish nobility also immigrated to Poland and became part of the Polish nobility. The history of the Ulster Scots overseas has been more mixed. Having begun their migration from Scotland to Ulster County before the cultural transformations which brought the Scottish people to the forefront of Western civilization, many Ulster Scots, or Scotch-Irish, did not fully share in that transformation. In colonial America, these Ulster Scots were more numerous than the Scots from Scotland. Among their many differences was that, when the Revolutionary War broke out, Ulster Scots overwhelmingly supported the American cause, while many of the Scots from Scotland remained loyal to England, or at least were opposed to another rebellion, after the military debacle and painful reprisals following the abortive Highland Rebellion of 1745. Although the Ulster Scots had neither socially nor biologically amalgamated with the indigenous Irish, they became known initially as Irish in the United States, but they made a point of calling themselves Scotch-Irish in 19th century America to distinguish themselves from the indigenous Irish immigrants who began arriving in large numbers at that time. The term Scotch-Irish has also been applied loosely to include not only Ulster Protestants in general, some of whom were in fact English, but also many people from the turbulent borderlands between England and Scotland, who often settled in the southern United States, interspersed with the Ulster Scots and sharing much of their ethos, having come from a similarly stormy and backward frontier region of Britain. Both came from places which, in the pre-industrial era, were thinly settled and desperately poor, the borderers from a part of England where the civilization was least developed, in the words of later scholars. The same description would be as apt for the Appalachian region of the United States, where the same two peoples settled and amalgamated to produce one of the most enduring pockets of poverty among white Americans. Most of the white population of the American South as a whole came not only from what has been loosely called the Celtic fringe, but also from that fringe at a particular time and particular stage of its cultural evolution. Had the South been peopled by 19th century Scots, Welshmen, and Ulstermen, the course of Southern history would doubtless have been radically different. 19th century Scottish and Scotch-Irish immigrants did in fact fit quite comfortably into Northern American society. Significantly, the Irish, who retained their Celtic ways, did not. But only a trickle of the flood of 19th century immigrants came into the South. The ancestors of the vast majority of Southerners arrived in America before the Anglicization of Scotland, Wales, and Ulster had advanced very far. The fringe of British civilization from which they came was notable not only for its poverty and backwardness, but also for its lawlessness and violence. These included the disputed borderlands between England and Scotland, a region accustomed to barbarity with slaughter, rape, and fire, where warfare between the two countries was marked by atrocities and counter-atrocities, and was supplemented by unofficial violence from marauders, vigilantes, and others who kept this a region which never enjoyed 50 consecutive years of quiet until the decisive English victories of 1745. By then, however, many people from this region had already immigrated to America, where the old traditions of violence survived long after they were suppressed in Britain. A similar tradition of violence and counter-violence existed in Ulster County, Ireland, between the indigenous Irish and the colonizing settlers, who were predominantly Scottish. Law being too tenuous to rely upon in such places, people developed patterns of settling differences by personal fighting and family feuds. The Ulster Scots and borderers brought these distinctive cultural patterns to the United States in general, and to the South in particular. Quite different from the Tidewater aristocracy of the South, both in their places of origins and in their respective ways of life in Britain and America, these common people of the more rural or backcountry regions were known as crackers and rednecks in Britain, even before they migrated to the American South. The term Hoosiers was also a common name for them, though in the United States this name was applied particularly to those Southerners who migrated into Indiana, and eventually to Indianans of whatever regional origins. Whatever they were called, the people whose ancestors immigrated from the most turbulent regions of Britain represented what one social historian has called some of the most disorderly inhabitants of a deeply disordered land. Given this background, it can hardly be surprising that hard drinking and the ruthless fighting called rough and tumble which included biting off ears or noses and gouging out eyes, became hallmarks of the southern backcountry way of life. Nor did it take much to get fighting started among these people, for, even in their poverty, they carried themselves with a fierce and stubborn pride that warned others to treat them with respect. Vigilante movements were another facet of their violent pattern, and the name Lynch Law has been traced to one of their number named William Lynch, whose followers often flogged and sometimes killed their victims. These patterns continued long after Lynch's death in 1820, with most victims being white until the Reconstruction era in the South after the Civil War, when blacks became the main targets. The fighting clans of Scotland have been claimed as models for the Ku Klux Klan, and the Fiery Cross of Old Scotland's Hills as the origin of the KKK's practice of burning crosses to intimidate blacks in the United States. In short, the pattern of ruthless violence directed by Southern whites against blacks originated long before there were any racial differences involved, and in fact, before the people of the Southern backcountry had boarded the ships in Britain which took them to their new homes in the American South. In the antebellum South, these backcountry people were seldom prosperous enough to own slaves, nor were the backcountry and upland regions in which they lived particularly suitable to plantation agriculture. Moreover, Ulster Scots settled both inside and outside the South. One of their earliest concentrations was in western Pennsylvania in colonial times, when it was frontier territory. There, the Scotch-Irish became known as troublesome settlers to the government and hard neighbors to the Indians. This did not necessarily represent any special racial animosity toward the Indians, for people of the same origin were notorious for squatting on land to which they had no legal title, not only in America, but also in Australia and New Zealand. From western Pennsylvania, Scotch-Irish settlements spread down through the Cumberland Gap into western Maryland, western Virginia, the Piedmont region of the Carolinas, and on into backcountry Georgia. In parts of this vast area, they shared the land with immigrants from Germany, but the two groups lived very different ways of life in separate communities and seldom intermarried. When Ulster Scots settled in colonial New England, one of the complaints against them by their neighbors was a lack of cleanliness, and a visitor to a Scotch-Irish settlement in Pennsylvania in the late 18th century likewise described their log cabins as being as dirty as in the north of Ireland or even Scotland. Among the Scotch-Irish, their pride was a source of irritation to their English neighbors, who could not understand what they had to feel proud about. Yet these immigrants, as unwelcome among the Quakers of eastern Pennsylvania as among the Puritans of Massachusetts or the Cavaliers of Virginia, included an elite of perhaps 1 or 2% who remained an elite in backcountry America. It was these elite families which produced such notable Americans of Scotch-Irish ancestry as Patrick Henry, Andrew Jackson, John Calhoun, James Polk, Zachary Taylor, Sam Houston, and others. Even among these elites, however, some of the old traditions still survived. Portraits of these men match contemporary descriptions of them as tall, lean, and sinewy, with hard, angry, weather-beaten features. Among the precepts that Andrew Jackson's mother taught him were never to sue anybody for slander or for assault and battery. Always settle them cases yourself. For centuries, sharp differences between the behavior patterns of white Southerners and white Northerners, especially New Englanders, were commented on by contemporary observers of American society and by scholars alike, in terms faithfully mirroring sharp differences seen in Britain between those from the main part of England, on the one hand, and the Irish, the Welsh, the Ulster Scots, and the Borderers on the other, those outside the central English culture often being lumped together as the Celtic fringe or as North Britons, though the Scottish Highlanders tended to be separate and distinct from the others. These cultural differences between American Northerners and Southerners extended from work habits to violence, cleanliness, alcohol consumption, inventiveness, food preferences, music, morals, and attitudes toward time, business, and education. A distinguished historian summarized the world encountered by Frederick Law Olmsted during his celebrated travels through the antebellum South. The meager standard of living, the shabby dwellings, the coarse and monotonous fare, the absence of cleanliness and ordinary comforts, the dearth of newspapers and other reading matter, appalled this Yankee, who had never encountered anything like this in even the humblest northern homes. What was involved was not simply poverty, but what Olmsted called lazy poverty, based on neglect of work, education, or other means of social betterment. Alexis de Tocqueville before him had likewise commented on ignorant and apathetic Southerners who were poor even on rich land and who lived in idle independence. Both Olmsted and de Tocqueville attributed these regional differences among whites in the United States to the effects of differences between slave states and free states, but the distinctive cultural patterns of these particular Britons and their descendants were at least as striking in those regions of the South where slavery was virtually non-existent, and the same differences between these same groups and most of the English in the British Isles could hardly be attributed to that cause, since slavery had long since disappeared in Britain. Although the English who settled around the world, especially in such offshoot societies as the United States, Canada, and Australia, are often thought of as a more or less homogeneous group to whose cultural norms others had to adjust in these societies, their internal differences have been as striking as those among different groups of Scots. Like many immigrants to other places around the world, most of those Britons who first settled in the Massachusetts Bay Colony came from a rather narrowly circumscribed area. Most originated within a 60-mile radius of the town of Haverhill in East Anglia, and even many of those who immigrated to Massachusetts from other parts of the British Isles had lived in East Anglia before moving to these other areas, from which they then immigrated to America. The special subculture which long characterized Massachusetts, and to some extent New England in general, and which distinguished it sharply from the subculture of the American South, for example, paralleled in many ways the subculture of East Anglia. Religiously, East Anglia was dominated by Puritans, as was the early Massachusetts colony. The austere, rigid, and cerebral religion of the Puritans, presented in plain churches with quietly grim sermons, contrasted with both the emotionalism of the Southern religious tradition and the institutional traditions of the Catholic Church. The importance to the Puritans of individual understanding of the Bible spurred them to promote widespread literacy and to produce, both in East Anglia and in Massachusetts, higher rates of literacy than in the general population and a disproportionate contribution to the intellectual elites of both Britain and colonial America. Nor was this reverence for education limited to an elite or even to those who were educated themselves. Hundreds of families throughout New England responded to appeals to donate either 12 shillings per family or a peck of grain to help support the fledgling little college established near the Charles River, early in the colony's history, by John Harvard. The intellectuality of the Puritans was a product of their religion and the rigid morality that derived from it. The Puritan colonies of America, like their counterparts in England, had much lower rates of illegitimacy than among their countrymen at large. The highly moralistic and uncompromising outlook of the Puritans eventually put them and their descendants on a collision course with the institution of slavery and produced, among others, Harriet Beecher Stowe, who was called by Abraham Lincoln the little lady who started the Civil War because of her novel Uncle Tom's Cabin. Once they decided that slavery was morally wrong, these descendants of the Puritans were undeterred in their opposition to it by economic, political, or social considerations. This moral rigidity had many sides, however. While it propelled the abolitionist movement in America, it also propelled the persecution of the Catholics in Ireland under Cromwell and his Puritan followers, as well as the witch hunts in colonial New England, which claimed more victims than in any other part of North America. It was not the ignorant who promoted the killing of women as witches, but some of the most highly educated people in the country. New England Puritans differed not only from the backcountry people of the South, but also from the Southern Tidewater aristocracy, who settled on the coastal plains of the American Eastern Seaboard and who originated largely in Southern and Western parts of England with a long tradition of very hierarchical societies, including, during the early Middle Ages, slavery. Dialects differed sharply between New England and Virginia, just as they differed between the respective areas of England from which New Englanders and Virginians came. Phrases such as I be and you be, as well as the use of the word yaller for yellow, axe for ask, and fambly for family, were common in both Virginia and in those parts of southern and western England from which Virginians had emigrated. Calling hogs' entrails chitlins, and using dough for door and flow for floor, or using dis and dat for this and that, were ways of talking that originated in this region and which persisted longer in the United States as part of southern dialect. The era of mass education and the standardization of the English language left such expressions as marks of uneducated people in the American South, and by the late 20th century, a pattern now christened Black English. Virginians ate highly seasoned food, which became a hallmark of southern cooking, along with much social interaction at mealtimes, while the Puritans in Massachusetts ate unseasoned food of little variety and with a minimum of light-hearted talk at the table. The fervor for establishing public schools in Massachusetts found no counterpart in Virginia, where illiteracy was much higher and education was largely restricted to those wealthy enough to afford to have their own children educated at home by tutors. In Virginia, the printing press was deliberately restricted by the powers that be to keep reading matter from the masses, while the aristocracy often had impressive libraries in their homes. Sexual mores were likewise radically different in the two places, illegitimacy being almost non-existent among the Puritans, with few brides being pregnant, while both pregnant brides and unwed mothers were far more common in Virginia. Rape was a capital offense in Massachusetts, but was usually given light punishment in Virginia. In both Virginia and in those parts of England from which Virginians came, it was common for male aristocrats to prey sexually on servant girls, their first victims in colonial America being white indentured servants, and only later black slave girls. Housing, gambling, and economic activities also differed sharply between Massachusetts and Virginia, as they differed between the two regions that Virginians and New Englanders came from in Britain. The names given to children likewise differed greatly between these two groups, both in England and in America. Edward, for example, was a popular name in Virginia and in Wessex, from which many Virginians emigrated, but the first 40 classes of undergraduates at Harvard College included only one student named Edward. It would be nearly two centuries before Harvard admitted anyone named Patrick, though this was a common name in western Pennsylvania, where the Scotch-Irish were settled. The British Empire. With Britain's emergence as a major nation in Europe, it began to rival and to challenge Spain, France, and other European powers internationally. A variety of political, military, economic, and other factors led these European powers to preempt various parts of the less developed world for their own purposes, including heading off rivals' efforts to foreclose particular regions of the globe as sources of gold, raw materials, markets, or military bases. For thousands of years, imperial conquests have been launched by Asians, Africans, and indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere, as well as by Europeans. What was different about modern imperialism was its global sweep, with large colonial possessions being scattered thousands of miles away across oceans. This presupposed a new level of economic resources and technological development, in which Europe was the leader, thereby creating a uniquely European age of overseas imperialism spanning the globe. Only gradually over the centuries did Britain move to the forefront of modern imperialism, ultimately establishing the largest empire the world has ever seen, encompassing one-fourth of the land area of the earth and one-fourth of the human race. Of the more than 11 million square miles of this empire in 1915, little more than one-tenth consisted of the British Isles themselves. In addition to places where the British themselves settled in large numbers, such as North America, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa, the British Empire stretched from Fiji Islands in the South Pacific to the island of Ireland in the North Atlantic. In Asia, it encompassed the Malay Peninsula, India, Burma, Ceylon, and the island colony of Hong Kong. It included vast areas of the African continent's east and west coasts, as well as Caribbean islands, British Guiana, Malta, and Gibraltar. Truly, the sun never set on the British Empire. The human costs and benefits of this empire were enormous and incalculable. Slaughters and even atrocities were not lacking, nor was hypocrisy or arrogance. Although slavery no longer existed in Britain itself during the era of the empire, the British became the world's largest slaveholders in their Western Hemisphere colonies in the Caribbean. Aborigines were dealt with brutally in Australia. Retaliation for the 1857 mutiny in India was both savage and humiliating, and 26,000 Boer women and children died in British concentration camps in South Africa. Racism often accompanied imperialism, but the British treatment of the Irish and the Boers suggested that a white skin did not provide immunity from the traumas accompanying conquest. Alongside this, and in no way offsetting it, but simply coexisting with it, was the spread of British technology, economic organization, law, and the English language that became a lingua franca not only within the vast British Empire, but also among peoples who were never part of that empire. In short, Britain shared the moral evils of conquerors in general, but what it contributed to the empire and to the world were uniquely its own. The first phase of British overseas expansion began in the 16th century in North America and the Caribbean. At that point, Britain was not yet unique. Spain established a contemporary empire that stretched continuously from San Francisco to the southern border of Argentina, as well as including the Philippines and parts of Europe. Only gradually did the British acquire an empire to rival or surpass that of Spain. By the middle of the 18th century, British forces drove the French out of Canada and India, but lost the American colonies to an insurrection abetted by France. Continued British expansion in the 19th century included both establishing a ruling structure over native populations, as in India and in much of Africa, and also largely supplanting the indigenes with a transplanted British population, as had happened in the North American colonies and was to happen again in Australia and New Zealand. These transplanted British populations evolved into self-governing countries, whether within or outside the British Empire, while the indigenous populations long continued to be ruled by British authorities, as in India or Nigeria, or by local white settlers, as in Rhodesia or South Africa. By 1912, the British Empire had a population of more than 440 million people, of whom only 10% lived in the British Isles. Despite its enormous size and diversity, the British Empire did not remain at its zenith for long, as history is measured. From the late Victorian Age, when African territories began to be acquired, until the post-World War II era, when independence came to India in 1947, and then spread rapidly to other parts of the British Empire around the world over the next two decades, was a span of less than a century. The military power that made Imperial Britain more dominant on the world scene than any nation before or since was based on its economic preeminence. The British Empire followed rather than caused that economic predominance, and the Empire played a remarkably small role in the British economy. Most British exports and investments did not go to its colonies. Europe was the principal outlet for British exports in the 18th century. Later, the United States became the principal outlet, receiving more than half of all British exports in the early 19th century. British overseas investments likewise tended to flow more to the advanced economies rather than to those of the Third World. As late as 1914, the United States represented the largest single investment destination of British capital overseas, receiving more British investments than all the non-European portions of Asia or Africa, or all of Latin America. Britain's other major overseas investments were also in European offshoot societies and economies in Australia, Canada, Rhodesia, and South Africa. Both the costs and the benefits of empire extended well beyond the economic. Gibraltar gave the British military command of the entrance to the Mediterranean, and a naval base at Singapore made the British Navy a power to be reckoned with in the Pacific. Britain remained the world's foremost naval power well into the 20th century, using as a rule of thumb the formula that its navy must be equal in size to the largest two other navies combined. Thus, in 1906, for example, when the German Navy had 31 battleships and the French Navy 29, the British Navy had 61 battleships. Only the later rise of the United States as a world naval power made this policy economically untenable, as the American Navy reached and then surpassed that of Britain during the 1920s. While Britain's overwhelming naval power and military strength made an empire possible, the incentives to create such an empire came from a variety of sources, of which economic gain was only one, and not necessarily the overriding one. Prestige, politics, and religion were also factors. British missionaries were not only a social influence abroad, but also a political force at home, a force sometimes on the side of imperial expansion, and sometimes a force against abuses of the conquered peoples by colonial officials, business interests, or indigenous tyrants. The greatest abuse of all, the slave trade, was ended as a direct result of the political influence of evangelical Christians in Britain, who were connected with missionary work in Africa. British imperialism, like some other imperialisms, brought to the conquered peoples both suffering and relief from suffering, new freedoms and new repressions, new opportunities and losses of old rights. Neither for the British themselves nor for those they conquered can an unambiguous net balance be totaled. In narrowly economic terms, however, the picture is much clearer. Counting the costs of conquest and administration, for example, against the profits and taxes extracted from the colonies, together with other economic pluses and minuses, Britain as a whole did not benefit economically from the colonies. Individual investors might make fortunes, Cecil Rhodes being the classic example, but the British taxpayers bore the heavy costs of maintaining the empire. Military defense was an especially heavy drain, leading to the world's largest burden of military expenditures per capita on the British people. Britain's economic impact on the colonies was far greater than the colonies' impact on the British economy. It was not simply that the conqueror brought more advanced technology to the conquered lands. The conquered peoples themselves were able to use the existing land with existing technology more effectively because food, for example, could now be grown in fertile but militarily indefensible areas where it would have been foolhardy to plant before. Such situations had existed in medieval Scotland, as well as later in Africa, in British dominions, and in those of many other nations. More generally, confidence that an investment of labor and resources could claim its reward, whether at harvest time or when dividends were issued years later, has been crucial to the economic efforts which create national prosperity. The security and stability provided by British colonial governments also made possible large-scale immigrations of foreign peoples, bringing new skills, talents, and energies. The Chinese immigration to Malaya, the Indians to East Africa, and the Lebanese to West Africa, for example, as well as similar internal migrations, such as those of the Marawis in India and the Igbos in Nigeria. The British Empire spread not only British hegemony, but also British technology, organization, capital, and the English language around the world. By the late 20th century, English was spoken by more people, about 1 billion, than any other language in the world. Only 330 million spoke it as their native tongue, compared to 750 million who spoke Mandarin Chinese, but English was the world's leading second language, serving as an international lingua franca among many non-English-speaking nations, as well as a means of direct communication with Britons, Americans, and other native English speakers. For peoples whose own native languages had no written literature, the English language opened vast new cultural horizons, encompassing not only the entire thought of the English-speaking world in medieval and modern times, but also much of the leading literature of the rest of the world, from ancient times to the present, available in English translations. The spread of English abroad was also paralleled by a standardization of English among the British themselves, as regional dialects began to erode, at least as early as the 19th century, a process accelerated in the 20th century by the mass media. The British Empire, at its zenith, required only about 120,000 soldiers and 6,000 civilians to run it. In modern times, this reflected enormous technological differences between cultures, ranging from the use of firearms to modern naval bombardment. But vast disparities in military effectiveness were apparent even in Roman times, when men on both sides killed each other at closer range with bows and arrows, or even face to face with swords. In the case of the Roman conquest of Britain, and of England's later conquests within the British Isles, the differing military effectiveness of cultures was also paralleled by their very different economic effectiveness. This was evidenced not only by their initial economic disparities, but also, especially in the case of Scotland and Wales, by the subsequent economic advancement of the conquered peoples. In Ireland, the mass confiscations of land and repression of economic opportunities for the Irish make the picture more ambiguous. However, even such a defender of Ireland and the Irish as Edmund Burke believed that the English conquest, for all its bitter injustices, left Ireland more prosperous. If so, it would be part of a wider historic pattern in which economic benefits to the conquered depend in no way on the goodwill of the conqueror. Much the same could be said of the British Overseas Empire. The international economic role of Britain as a supplier of capital to the world market was greater than, and different from, Britain's role as an imperial power. Most British capital in the world market went outside the empire, and what did get invested within the empire was invested mostly in the autonomous European offshoot societies, such as Canada and Australia. Contrary to many theories of imperialism, this greatest of all empires did not revolve around an export of capital to the Third World. The evolution of freedom. Britain's economic pioneering and imperial triumphs were by no means its only legacy to the world. Freedom, wherever it exists in the world today, owes much to developments in Britain. These include not only the historic evolution of a free society in the United Kingdom itself, providing political models and legal precedents for other free societies around the world, but also Britain's key role in destroying the international slave trade in the 19th century and its crucial role when the survival of freedom in the world was threatened in the early and dark days of World War II. Freedom was by no means a constant throughout British history, nor did it grow smoothly over time. In the repeated jockeying for power between kings and parliaments, between religious denominations, or between nobles and commoners, the boundaries of freedom were frequently shifting. Nevertheless, the idea of separated powers and of rules governing all the contenders for power became embedded in British tradition over the centuries. The uneven, uncertain, and inconsistent evolution of the institutions and traditions of freedom in Britain followed no blueprint or elaborated doctrine. Its pattern is more discernible in retrospect than among those living through those historic centuries, preoccupied with fierce rivalries between dynasties, churches, courts contending among themselves for jurisdiction, foreign wars, and the enduring and bitter battles at home between Parliament and monarchs. Out of this apparent chaos, however, emerged institutions, traditions, and landmarks on the road to human freedom in general, as well as for the freedom of the British themselves. The first and most famous of these landmarks was, of course, Magna Carta, a political agreement which avoided armed conflict growing out of narrow and bitterly disputed interests between King John and his nobles, and whose historic significance for the rest of the people of England, and ultimately the world, may not have been at all obvious when this political compromise was adopted in 1215. King John had provoked this incipient rebellion among his nobles by heightened taxation and other extractions of money under numerous pretenses, all in hopes of being able to finance a reconquest of his lost territories in Normandy. Yet, from this dispute among a small ruling elite, came the tradition that people had established rights which even the king himself was required to respect. This meant that kings and queens of England could not be absolute monarchs, as rulers in so many other parts of the world were, and that the separation of powers became part of the basic political structure of the country. While the kings of England retained enormous prerogatives for hundreds of years, they were increasingly confronted by Parliament, which was a powerful counterweight because of its control of taxation. Separated powers meant mutually limited powers, powers delineated in advance, as rulers and parliaments sought to guard the boundaries of their respective prerogatives, with the net result, over the centuries, of freeing an expanding portion of the population from arbitrary edicts. The fact that Britain was an island, dependent for its military defense primarily on its navy, meant that for much of its history, large standing armies were unnecessary and unknown, and were regarded with great suspicion. Since navies are not usable for domestic oppression like armies, both the government and the people were spared the dangers long inherent in standing armies. For much of its later history, the British landed aristocracy, unlike that in some continental European countries such as Russia, was locally based, both in economic and in political power terms. This meant that the landed nobility threw its weight behind a decentralization of power, especially since these local elites would themselves exercise much of that power as justices of the peace and in other roles. By contrast, the Russian nobility derived much of its economic sustenance and political power from its role as either military or civil agents of the central government, and therefore threw its weight behind Tsarist despotism. However locally despotic the British aristocracy might be in particular places and times, the decentralization which it promoted and its enduring opposition to large standing armies served to prevent the greater despotism possible by a centralized government. There were numerous overlapping jurisdictions in the law between religious and secular courts, and between baronial and royal jurisdictions, while many local legal traditions further fragmented the legal system of Britain. Over the centuries, however, there emerged a body of law common to the country as a whole, laws growing by the accretion of judicial precedents and known as the common law. Because the common law was not simply the creature of political power holders, it became another of the forces for separation of powers and of rights limiting the scope of officials. A second landmark in the evolution of English government were the series of armed struggles between Parliament and King in the 17th century, punctuated by the beheading of Charles I in 1649 and the flight of James II in 1688. In the face of uprisings against him and defections from his own supporters. At the heart of these events were the attempts of successive Stuart monarchs to wield more arbitrary power than Parliament was prepared to tolerate. After a decade without a king, following the overthrow and execution of Charles I, England restored the Stuart monarchy in 1660, when Charles II ascended the throne. But after his death in 1685, his son James II returned to attempts at arbitrary rule such as had doomed his grandfather. Far more important and of more enduring consequence than the changing of monarchs that followed, however, was the Bill of Rights proclaimed under the new monarchs, William and Mary, seeking to consolidate support for their newly established reign. Law was made supreme, with the king no longer empowered to remove judges, who now became arbiters between crown and subject, acting on standards of law. While an independent judiciary had been the ideal before, what made it revolutionary now was that it became a reality when judges' appointments could no longer be revoked except for misconduct, and that could be done only by Parliament, which was itself removable by the electorate. This was part of a more general restructuring of government to produce greater freedom and religious toleration, as well as the rule of law. Beyond the Bill of Rights itself, but in the same spirit, freedom of the press from prior censorship was instituted in 1695. All these things, which are now so much taken for granted, can be taken for granted only because the British pioneered in their development. Moreover, Britain as a nation became a stronger international force as internal, dynastic, and religious strife subsided, and Parliament became more willing to supply monarchs with the funds needed to build up the country's military and naval forces, now that they no longer feared royal despotism. Thus, Britain was able to counterbalance the military threat that France posed to the British Isles and to the rest of Western Europe. Because Britain was an island nation, the revolutionary doctrine that people had rights which kings could not override was able to be fought out and won within the British Isles, without effective intervention from other monarchs on the European continent, to whom such doctrines were an obvious threat, even though both Charles II and James II had sought such intervention in order to try to save their throne and their royal prerogatives. The triumph of this revolutionary concept of political freedom and the emergence of Britain as a great power on the world stage marked, as a distinguished British historian put it, a turning point in the history of our country and of the world. The repetition of the same phrase, Bill of Rights, a century later, to describe the first 10 amendments to the Constitution of the United States, was one of the first emanations of these principles beyond the shores of the British Isles. It would not be the last, however, as the ideas of political freedom and the rights of citizens spread to other European nations and their offshoot societies overseas and to other civilizations. Even where these ideas did not triumph or endure, they were ideas difficult to extinguish, and sometimes they modified at least the appearances, and in some respects the practices, of authoritarian governments. As British parliamentary government became the mother of parliaments in other countries, so the British legal system became a model for other countries, thereby promoting freedom for other peoples and other countries. While British law spread around the world directly with the development of the British Empire, the concepts it introduced and the traditions it nurtured continued long after many colonies became independent nations. This was especially so in transplanted British societies like Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. However, even in an outwardly different political and legal system in the United States, the same underlying principles of limited government, separation of powers, and an independent judiciary were at the heart of the American Constitution. British political and legal principles sometimes left an enduring influence, even in some former British colonies with non-Western populations and non-Western traditions of government. British legal principles and precedents continued to be cited in the courts of independent India, and an independent Sri Lanka for a time continued to permit its legal decisions to be appealed to the Privy Council in London. Not all former British colonies established or preserved British governmental structures or principles, or the freedom based on them. But the line of demarcation between those that did and those that did not largely coincided with the line between free people and those living under various forms of despotism. Freedom must be distinguished from democracy, with which it is often confused. The British people had many rights that were lacking in much of Europe and in most of the rest of the world, long before they acquired the franchise with which to control the government. Few of the members of Parliament were elected by popular vote prior to the Reform Act of 1832. Yet freedom of speech, separation of powers, the right to a jury trial, and the other hallmarks of a free society existed in Britain for generations before then. Perhaps an even more remarkable contribution of Britain to the growth of freedom in the world was its leading role in the destruction of the international slave trade, and then of slavery itself. The magnitude of this achievement is hard to appreciate without first recognizing that slavery was a worldwide institution, entrenched on every inhabited continent, subjugating people of every color, language, and religion, and going back thousands of years. Moreover, the effort to stamp out slave trading, and later the institution of slavery itself, encountered widespread resistance and evasions in many regions of the world, producing a bitter struggle that lasted for more than a century. The dogged persistence of the British in that struggle was a key factor in the ultimate destruction of slavery around the world. Not all British leaders or colonial officials shared the ideals or the fervor of the anti-slavery movement, but the political pressures generated by that movement remained powerful and unrelenting throughout the 19th century, and could not be ignored by any British government of any party during that era. It would be hard to find anywhere in history a record of any other country going to such efforts for so long in a cause from which it could gain so little and lose so much. When the British anti-slavery movement began in the late 18th century, Britain was itself the leading slave-trading nation in the world, and its slave plantations in the British West Indies and elsewhere were prospering and growing, producing powerful vested interests in London, interests which were nevertheless crushed by the swelling moral revolt against the institution of slavery. One of the many ironies of history was that this leading slave-trading nation became the leading destroyer of the slave trade, and eventually of slavery itself. Another irony was that the strong vested interests which initially fought off the anti-slavery movement for 20 years in Parliament only succeeded in making that movement's ultimate triumph more sweeping than even its advocates could have hoped at the outset of the struggle. The protracted nature of that struggle led to ever wider public awareness of the issues and ever growing public outrage against all aspects of slavery, ultimately sweeping the anti-slavery movement beyond its own original goal of abolishing the slave trade to seeking the abolition of slavery itself throughout the British Empire and then throughout the world. Organized opposition to slavery arose in 18th century England among the Quakers, who began to require their members to free their own slaves. Evangelical members of the Anglican Church transformed anti-slavery sentiment into a political movement, with William Wilberforce and Henry Thornton leading the parliamentary battle for the end of the slave trade. Beaten badly in Parliament at the outset, the anti-slavery forces continued the fight until Parliament finally voted overwhelmingly to ban the international slave trade in 1808. By then, ever-widening opposition to slavery led to petitions from all parts of the country arriving in London with hundreds of thousands of signatures from people of the humblest ranks to those of the titled nobility. This was unprecedented in an era before mass communications or mass transportation. Banning slavery throughout the British Empire was more than simply a matter of enacting laws. Since slaves were legally property, their owners had to be compensated for their emancipation, and that cost the British government £20 million, a huge sum in the 19th century, when the pound sterling was of far greater value than today. Even this was not the full cost of the anti-slavery crusade, however, for the British attack on slavery was not limited to banning it for Britons, but sought to stop other nations from engaging in the slave trade as well. Through political influence, economic bribes, and military threats, Britain was able to gain the acquiescence of many, though not all, nations to its boarding of their vessels on the high seas to search for slaves. Where slaves were found, they were freed and the vessels confiscated. Powerful nations such as France would not submit to British pressure, and slave traders of various nationalities began to fly the French flag, with or without French permission, to avoid being boarded by the British. However, after the anti-slavery movement spread to France itself, the French then followed the British in abolishing slavery and in using their navy to patrol the seas in search of slave-carrying ships. After the American Civil War, the U.S. Navy also joined the anti-slave patrols in the Atlantic. Eventually, the anti-slavery crusade took root in the moral consciousness of European civilization as a whole, even in despotic countries such as Tsarist Russia, which stamped out the slave trade in Central Asia. The world dominance of Great Britain enabled it to impose its anti-slavery edicts on many other sovereign nations. Even while fighting a major war against Napoleon, Britain kept some of its navy on patrol off the African coast to intercept slave ships. Nor did it always confine itself to naval actions near Africa. In 1849, the British Navy struck at Brazil's slave ships in Brazilian waters. In 1849 and 1850, the British government took drastic action against the slave merchants in Brazilian territorial waters, in complete disregard of Brazilian sovereignty, with the intention of wresting a commitment from the Brazilian government to pass an effective anti-slave trade law and see to its enforcement. Thoroughly humiliated by British incursions into the harbors of the empire and their seizure and destruction of Brazilian slave ships, even within Brazilian territorial waters, faced with threats to the legal shipping of the empire, with military conflict and even a blockade of Brazilian ports, the government of the empire was compelled in July 1850 to accede to British demands in exchange for a promise to suspend the naval attacks. Similar naval efforts at intercepting the slave trade from East Africa were carried on by the British for decades. The Arab and Indian slave traders in the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea, and the Persian Gulf responded like their European counterparts in the Atlantic by using smaller, sleeker craft designed to outrun or evade naval vessels. Moreover, Middle Eastern slave traders using smaller vessels were often able to sail in coastal waters too shallow for British warships. Although the East African slave trade had been surpassed by that of West Africa, it was by no means negligible. Well over 1 million human beings were shipped out of Africa as slaves in the 19th century from ports on the Indian Ocean or the Red Sea. British naval vessels, scattered over vast expanses of open water, could capture only a small fraction of the ships carrying slaves, often hidden among ordinary merchandise, rather than constituting the main cargo, as in the Atlantic. But the British Navy could impose risks and costs on slave traders at sea and in ports, the cumulative effect of which was to reduce the traffic. In the Atlantic slave trade as well, the reduction in the number of slaves shipped from Africa to the Western Hemisphere was slight in the early decades of the 19th century, but unrelenting efforts at interception on the high seas over the years eventually destroyed the Atlantic slave trade by about 1860. By this time, the slave trade across the Sahara was also drastically reduced, partly as a result of a ban by the Ottoman Empire in 1857 under pressure from Britain. Gradually, grudging and piecemeal concessions by the Ottoman Empire reduced the importation of slaves from Africa, though much smuggling of black slaves continued, and the importation of white slaves from the Caucasus region continued to flourish. At one point, the British threatened to send warships into the Mediterranean to inspect Turkish ships and punish those found to be carrying slaves, if the Ottoman Empire did not do a better job of policing the slave trade itself. Aggressive British actions elsewhere in the world meant that this was not an idle threat. Resistance in the Islamic countries was formidable, sometimes expressed in armed uprising against both the Ottoman Empire and the British, but more often was expressed in widespread evasions of the ban on slave trading. Banning the institution of slavery itself long remained only a distant hope in much of Africa and the Middle East, even after it was a reality in the Western Hemisphere. Before the end of the 19th century, slavery was abolished throughout the Western Hemisphere, and the spread of European colonies and spheres of influence in Africa in the late 19th century meant that slavery was coming under increasing pressure there as well. Slavery retreated before the advance of British power in Africa and Asia, as it was later to retreat before the advance of French and German power in Africa, before the advance of Dutch power in the East Indies, and the advance of Russian power in Central Asia. Yet the impetus for the abolition of slavery was a peculiarity of Western civilization, though some non-Western nations eventually began to move against slavery as a means of maintaining their national standing in the eyes of the world, which is to say, primarily the Western world. In a later era, Britain again played a key role in the defense of freedom when totalitarian governments sprang up between the two world wars of the 20th century, and many, even in democratic countries, called these aggressive, nationalistic, and racist dictatorships the wave of the future. That prediction seemed especially ominous when the early aggressions of Germany, Italy, and Japan in the 1930s and early 1940s succeeded time and again. After Nazi armies rampaged through Europe in the early years of the Second World War, winning an unbroken series of swift and stunning victories, climaxed by the fall of France in just 6 weeks of fighting, Britain faced the seemingly invincible forces of Nazi Germany alone. Few expected her to survive. Prime Minister Winston Churchill put the grim situation to his people and to the world. "The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties, and so bear ourselves that, if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, 'This was their finest hour.'" As Churchill predicted, the full might and fury of the Nazis were turned on Britain. The dreaded massive bombing of the Luftwaffe, which had terrorized other nations into surrender, failed to break the British. Hitler was stopped for the first time. Britain, though lacking the military forces to launch a major counterattack, nevertheless stalled the Nazi timetable of conquest, thus buying time, not only for itself, but also for an almost completely disarmed United States to begin preparing itself militarily for the ordeal ahead. Many nations, forces, and events contributed to the final victory over Germany and Japan, but what made it all possible was that Britain withstood the fire and blast of war and refused to surrender, even when the situation looked hopeless. It was indeed their finest hour. Freedom survives in the world today because of it. Summary and implications. The history of the British people, like the history of other peoples around the world, illustrates the enormous importance of human capital, whether in the form of specific skills, general education, or traditions and laws that facilitate both economic development and the development of free institutions. The many centuries that it took for the British to rise from cultural and economic backwardness to the forefront of world civilization in technology and political dominance suggests something of the difficulty of acquiring the necessary human capital. The vital role played in this process by numerous other peoples who came to the British Isles, whether as conquerors, immigrants, or refugees, also suggests how important cultural diffusion is. The Romans, the Normans, the Jews, the Lombards, and the Huguenots all contributed in important ways at different historical junctures to what would ultimately become a British achievement. The geography of the British Isles also played an important role, not in determining what people would do, but in determining the boundaries of what was possible. The simple fact that Britain is an island nation, and that water transport is vastly cheaper than land transport, and was especially so in the era before railroads, meant that the British could transport heavy raw materials, like coal, to different parts of the United Kingdom much more cheaply and rapidly than was possible within nations with large interiors, such as Germany or the United States, both of which had to wait for the era of railroads to challenge the British in industrialization. The fact that the key raw materials of the industrial age, iron ore and coal, were located very near each other and also near navigable waterways in Britain, again gave the British decisive early advantages over countries like Germany and the United States, as well as permanent advantages over regions of the world where such natural resources do not exist at all and cannot be imported at any feasible economic cost. Significantly, Japan, one of the few countries that was later able to rise to the industrial forefront without such natural resources, is an island like Britain, and no part of Japan is more than 70 miles from the sea, so imported raw materials could be brought in economically, as would be virtually impossible in the Balkans or in much of sub-Saharan Africa, for example, due to more formidable geographical barriers in these places. Geographical advantages and cultural imports have permitted more to be accomplished within the British Isles than in many other parts of the world, but ultimately, it was the British themselves who had to accomplish it. That they did so has had enormous consequences, not only for the inhabitants of the United Kingdom, or even for past and present members of the British Empire or Commonwealths, but for the entire world. The highly varying degrees to which different segments of the British population acquired the necessary human capital demonstrates that the opportunity alone is not sufficient for economic or other accomplishments. Nor was it simply a matter of what the existing society permitted to different groups, for those same groups showed similar economic and social patterns when transplanted to other societies in North America or in Australia and New Zealand. British law and its traditions of impartiality made London a magnet for the capital of the world, enabling Britain to industrialize with other people's capital as well as its own. In a later era, the British colony of Hong Kong would similarly attract capital from around the world by the dependability and impartiality of its laws, while many poverty-stricken countries were unable to obtain much-needed capital because of their undependable laws and confiscatory policies toward foreign investors. British law was, of course, more than an economic asset. Its separation of powers and rights of citizens against the government were the foundation of the freedom of the British themselves. The revolutions of the 17th century, including the beheading of King Charles I in 1649 and the uprisings in 1688 that led James II to flee to France, made the separation of powers even more dramatically vindicated and an indelible part of the British Constitution. While many other countries copied British systems of law and government, those that succeeded in creating similarly free governments were largely those that came from the same tradition, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, for the historical experiences that were distilled into powerful traditions were essential to the functioning of the legal and political institutions themselves. While these institutions could be copied by anyone, the history and traditions behind them could not be synthesized, and it was these intangibles that made the tangible institutions and structures work.